Yeah, once you see them thicken, start adding it to board it. And then just leave it to see. I'll put this out. So then it goes dark, and then you can't see it because you're not seeing the rest of it. But yeah, usually they do something.
When must we ready to start? Members, if I can just give you an indication before I open the meeting officially of how we're going to approach today. The IPAS report, the BRR report, members received this morning. And in fairness, I want members to have an opportunity to go through it. So what we are going to do is that we're going to start with the CIRA legislation this morning. We will then, when we get back after the budget, budget statement, we will then first start, and the team can be here and sit here. It will be good for them to hear what we found on them as well. And then we will start with the two reports, both CIRA and SAPS report for adoption. So we will adopt the two reports immediately after the budget year, statement this afternoon. We are scheduled to sit after the budget statement. Until best of our 7 o'clock, I think, 7 o'clock tonight. We're also scheduled to sit tomorrow until 7 o'clock. Tomorrow, however, we will meet close to the chambers because there might be times that we have to break for voting. That is on the program that was distributed to members. Ms. Quillebon?
Just tell me, you said we received this morning the BRR report from IDED. It wasn't in a pension hall. I haven't. Is it around here somewhere, maybe?
If you haven't received it, we will make sure that you get a copy now. Can I just get an indication that other members got the IPAS report? You've got yours. Okay, anybody else got it? We will just check now that you get a copy of it. Here's a copy coming to you. Members, that one is not as long as the SAPS one, obviously, so if you can just have a look at it so that we can then later on today adopt these two reports. We, in opening the meeting, let me welcome members and also the technical team who was tasked last year November to start looking at the proposed changes that came from the committee. I must also express my dissatisfaction with the fact that we got this all so late, despite the fact that there was basically 11 months for you to draft this. It's putting the committee under extreme pressure during a time where committees are busy with BRR reports, and at a time where Parliament is in the process of wrapping up its work as well. I do not take kindly to that on behalf of the members of this committee. We are going to start the process and we're going to go through page by page. So, Secretary, you were appointed as the leader for the technical team who's leading us from your side.
Can you just clarify something for me? On the bulletin administrative leave, but in Nicolette's notes on page 3, it now says that it's a committee bill. Now, a committee bill, having looked at the back, means it's got to go straight through the whole business again, it's got to have hearings again. It's a huge, long process that we've got to go through. That's the definition of a committee bill. So I'm very concerned that if it's been reclassified, we basically are going back to scratch and have to, according to the regulations laid out by Parliament, we have to go through public hearings again, the whole process. So could someone clarify for me, please?
It's not classified as a committee bill. It might be a mistake on that side, but it's not classified as a committee bill. It's a bill introduced by the minister, and he made changes to it. And we had our public hearings and everything, and the changes, if members remember, were changes that were based on the input that we received during the public hearings. So let's just relax that one. I mean, it's the researcher's notes. So, okay.
Yeah. So unused to collect getting anything tricky. Yeah.
Fine. I mean, I don't think you collect for it either. But can we start immediately, please? Page by page. Let's start page by page, starting on page one, with me as secretary.
Chair, can I introduce the delegation? I'll introduce the legal team, and then I will ask the chairperson to just introduce her. On my far right is General Jacobs. Next to me is Mr. Soman, and on my left is Mr. Umbell, and there's Lisa from the State Law Team, and Deboko from the legal services is here. The therapy to introduce himself, and then ask Mr. Soman and Mr. and General Jacobs to take us through page by page.
State law advisors, I presume you're referring to, not state law attorneys. I'm definitely not paying for state law attorneys' time. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry.
Continue, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. On Sira's side, we have Director of Sira Mabela, and we, on my left hand side, we have Mr. Benjamin Dooley, the council member, and we have the Chairperson of Sira present, and we also have our Cape Town Regional Manager also visiting us.
Okay, you can start, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, on page two, with a long title, as usually I think we'll come back to the long title at the end of the process. Chair, I can just mention that we have actually been working on two documents. This one setting out the bill's provisions or proposals within the context of the broader act or the present act. And then, of course, a second document, which is a bill that is extracted from this. But, of course, the second document might need to be changed after we have gone through this process. Chair,
sorry, can I just be clear? Are you working from the one with the red in colour?
So I'm
working,
Chair,
from the document in colour.
We'll be working on the full act at the moment.
Thanks.
It is marked on top 1110 on the first page, Chair. Chair, just on the definitions and the arrangement of sections, we have inserted 12A Secretariat. There's a change on funds, which is now Finances of the Authority. 16A is Annual Report, which is a new insertion. 17, 18 and 19 are deleted. And then in Chapter 3, 20A, the
Commissioner Jacobs, before you go on with that, you know, I thought the Secretary would refer to the matters that was referred for consultation before we stopped the process. Because we 11 months down the line, part of what you had to go and do was to talk to Treasury, was to talk to DTI, and to get clarity from them on the issues and the concerns that they've raised. Can we first get feedback on that? Because we've gone through the bill, and there's things that have been removed that was in the introduced bill. Now, that indicates that something that we don't want to assume, so we want to hear what the situation is.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, I'm asked to give a brief response. In terms of the work done on the bill since the 21st of November last year, the process was that we engaged with the Department of Trade and Industry. We have meetings with the Department of Trade and Industry, State Security, Department of Finance to Treasury, and Home Affairs on the provisions, the key provisions relating to funding of CIRA, as well as the matters relating to the prohibition on foreign involvement. As you recall, Chair, the decision of the committee last year was to remove that provision that relates to the provision on restriction on foreign involvement. But in terms of the consultation with the stakeholders, there is work in progress. The DTI has raised its strong objections, both in terms of the document it submitted and in discussions in the joint interdepartmental committee.
Chairman Mulabhan, so you've got a point of order, President. Check. The issue here is most of the presenters, if not all, were concerned about the conduct issue. The question is, how far are you in addressing that problem? That's it.
And also, I think you need to correct it. The committee didn't say withdraw anything. The committee said to you, go and consult on these issues. And based on the consultation processes, come back to us and tell us. The committee didn't say withdraw ownership or not. We didn't take a decision on it. We said we've got to go and consult further on the issue. Mr. Stuber, that another point of order?
Yeah, no, what I would suggest is what I would like to have is surely there was notes to the extent what should be done. I would like to get a copy of that note and I would like to receive the, what they had to do, answer on that, also in writing.
That's fine, they can provide that as continue, please. But, I mean, let's just correct it, because this is going on the record now. The committee did not ask for anything to be withdrawn. We said we will consult because proper consultation was clearly not done when the bill was introduced. Continue, please.
Jay, can I just clarify, because it wasn't just on the ownership issue. There were also issues around the financing of CIRA that we needed to consult with National Treasury around. There was also the issue of citizenship, so it wasn't just the ownership issue that had to be consulted. So we actually had a joint team that we put together that involved Home Affairs, as Mr. Simon said, Home Affairs, DTI, State Security, National Treasury, ourselves, and we involved Justice in the process as well, the Department of Justice in that process. There are some issues which we have reached consensus on as that group. And there are some issues which are still quite sticky issues. And the issue that is still quite sticky is the ownership issue. So we have not brought it back to committee because we have not reached consensus on that issue. On the issue of financing of the authority, we have reached consensus on that and we have proposed a clause in the bill. And on the issue of citizenship, we have reached an agreement on that, which is then contained in the amendment. So there is one outstanding issue that we are still working on, and that is an area where we couldn't reach consensus, and that was the issue of the ownership.
We can get clarity now. We're not going back to that issue of ownership. For this purpose of tightening this bill, the bill is going without that issue. You see, if you reach consensus at whatever point in time, you, the department, the minister will reintroduce an amendment at that point in time. Is that what? Okay, so can we continue?
Chair, in terms of the consultations that has been in addition to what the Secretary has indicated, Chair, as far as the technical team is concerned, the amendments and the committee changes have been accommodated, and I take the point from the Honourable Member who will provide a list of all the areas. Save for that, Chair, I think we can proceed without taking the Chair's role. Process-wise, that has been a process, that's what I think.
And you will submit summary of the notes and things to the committee. Can we have it by tomorrow morning at the latest, please? Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just one further. On Chapter 3, there was an insertion exemption advisory committee, 20A, and then in Chapter 6, 36A, also an insertion security services rendered outside the Republic. Chair, if we go to page 7.
I want us to go through it systematically. So let's go to the first changes that we have. Page 2 is the first one. But that is
You've said we can come back to that one later. Page 3, there are no new changes. Page 4, there are changes. That is also in more detail in the bill. Chapter 3 is basically the index that we're talking about. Members, anything on page 4? Page 5?
If I can just raise it now, and then we can, because it's mentioned throughout, there was some confusion about the authority reporting to the council, the council to the minister, and there's some of the sentences were backwards. Has that all been corrected throughout? Because I just raised it here because it's the first time it's going to come up, and I don't have to raise it throughout.
We will check on it as we go on. We have yesterday already discovered some places where it's not been tightened up. So can we continue then, please? Page 5, you've been security services rendered outside of public, and then page 6, there's nothing. Continue from page 7, but I would ask you to stop off that section so that we can then just first discuss that section, please.
Thank you, Chair. Section 1, then. Chair, marked in red, the insertion of the definition of civilian secretariat means the National Civilian Secretariat for the Police Service, established in terms of Section 4.1 of the Civilian Secretariat for the Police Service Act 2011, Act No. 2 of 2011. Chair, then, an amendment to the definition of company, just to align it with the new Companies Act. Company means a company within the meaning of the Companies Act 2008, Act number 71 of 2008. Chair, then on the next page, page 8, Levies Act means the Private Security Industry Levies Act. We have just inserted the reference to the Act 2002, Act number 83 of 2002. And locksmith means a person who, for the benefit of another person, engages in any activity or business which is related to, believe that, A, designing and managing master key systems, B, installing, maintaining, repairing and changing the combinations of safes, vaults and security safe deposit boxes, C, maintaining key code records, D, Chair, and here I must say we have gone back to our records and I think there are words that had to be deleted. Let's just read it out as it should be. Cutting keys, they must be deleted otherwise than by. And duplicating existing keys. Or E, opening, closing or engaging of locking mechanisms of any nature by means of a specialized device in any manner. Then the definition of minister means the minister.
We stop there, please, because there is surely in my mind the question. One of the issues that were raised by the locksmiths that we also said you must go and look at is making provision for artisans within the locksmith industry. Now I see there's still no provision for artisans. Because as the Act currently says, stands, an artisan will not be able to make, I don't have to repeat the argument, but the artisan will not be able to make keys. If he does, or she does, it will be illegally so because they're not registered, because they haven't fulfilled their training, yet making the keys is part of the training. So we have said that must be included as well.
Thank you, Chair. We noted and we will do that. Chair, in the definition of national treasury means the national treasury is established by Section 5 of the Public Finance Management Act. The definition of organ of state means an organ of state as defined in Section 239 of the Constitution, 1996, but does not include the security services referred to in Section 199 of the Constitution. Chair, then on page 10, the insertion of Public Finance Management Act means the Public Finance Management Act 1999, Act No. 1 of 1999. Then the definition of security business means subject to Section 25. Any person who renders a security service to another for remuneration, reward, fee or benefit, except the person acting only as a security officer.
That's not what our copy is saying. Subject to Section 2, it says.
Yeah. If I can just explain, there's two definitions. The one marked in yellow is the proposed one. We can just delete the preceding one, Chair.
So members, you've got it. The first, security business needs to be deleted, the definition. The second one can stay. Can I hear members, are you satisfied with that? Okay. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 11, the definition of security officer means any natural person.
Sorry, can you just go back to page 10 as well? Just a question. And the security equipment, should we not refer to the relevant act? I think you gave me a copy as well. I'm just asking the question. As defined in or...
Chair, no, this definition is for this. There's other definitions that relate to the interception, but I don't think it's relevant to this definition here.
Continue then.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, the definition of security officer means any natural person, a Roman one who is employed by another person, including an organ of state, subject to section 21A and B of the Act, and who receives or is entitled to receive from such other person any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit for rendering one or more security services, or to assist in carrying on or conducting the affairs of another security service provider, and who receives or is entitled to receive from such other security service provider or any other person any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit as regards one or more security services.
Sorry, you read assist carrying in. Can you read that first, the second Roman 2 for us again?
Chair, who assists in carrying on or conducting the affairs of another security service provider, and who receives or is entitled to receive from such other security service provider or any other person any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit as regards one or more security services.
Maybe anything on here? I think continue.
Thank you, Chair. Then E on page 12, on the definition of security service. Chair, I think this is the matter that you refer to now. The manufacturing, assembling, possessing, selling, purchasing, or advertising of listed equipment contemplated in section 1 of the regulation of interception of communication and provision of communication-related information act. Act number 70 of 2002, authorized by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development under section 45, brackets 2, and section 46, brackets 1, bracket A, bracket 2 of the said Act. Chair, if I could just explain, if one look at section 45 of the Regulation of Interception of Communications and Provision of Communications-Related Information Act, it provides that subject to subsection 2 and section 46, no person may manufacture, assemble, possess, sell, purchase, or advertise any illicit equipment. Then subsection 2 provides that the subsection 1 does not apply to any telecommunications service provider or other person who or law enforcement agency which manufactures, assembles, possesses, sells, purchases, or advertises illicit equipment under the authority of a certificate of exemption issued to him or her or it for that purpose by the Minister under Section 46. Chair, I think this provision is now written or drafted in line with the provisions of the Regulation of Interception of Communications Act in order to provide for that exemption where the Minister of Justice need to authorize the manufacturing of such equipment.
Liz, can I hear anyone on this? Are we satisfied? Seems like it. Continue.
Thank you, Chair. Then, Chair, on the bottom there, D is...
On the bottom you wanted to raise? Fine, okay.
On the bottom of page 12, there's a G, which is G and H on page 13, which is still marked in blue. It was on the previous text, but there's no amendment to that, Chair. The wording is exactly the same still as in the original text of the legislation. And Chair, K on page 13... making a person or the services of a person available, whether directly or indirectly, for the rendering of any service referred to in paragraphs A to J, L and LA to another person. Then L managing, controlling, or supervising the rendering of any of the services referred to in paragraphs A to J and LA, and then the insertion of LA, protecting or safeguarding of cash or goods with a high value, including precious metals or jewelry when transported on public road, except when transported by a person at his or her own account, or by the South African National Defence Force, or in the case of transport by escort of the service. Then, creating the impression in any manner that any one or more of the services in paragraphs A to LA are rendered.
Ms. Kulubana?
Can I just, want to check something, if we can go back a paragraph. And this goes to the research notes that we went through. The issue of RICA in relation, the RICA Act, as it were, and the Secretary was asked to provide examples of these. The committee expressed concern. One cannot regulate something that's prohibited. So you're referring to interception devices, CIE, but in relation to the Regulation of Interception of Communication, Provision of Communications Related Information Act, they're forbidden. So how does that tie in with another act? Are we not causing a problem here? And I'll go on to the other one when we get there.
Chair, as I've mentioned, the prohibition in the Regulation of Interception and Communications Act is not a total prohibition. It provides for the Minister of Justice to give exemption, certificate of exemption, in terms of the manufacturing. And if one further look at Section 46 as well, it says the Minister may, upon application and in consultation with the relevant ministers, exempt any internet service provider, secondly a telecommunications service provider, or any other person from one or all of the prohibited acts. So although there is prohibition on the manufacturing, it is subject to an authorization which must be given by the Minister of Justice before a person may lawfully, and I think the bill is now drafted in line with that prohibition in the Act. Thanks.
Anything else? Anything else before we carry on?
Before we move on, just the session after that talks about security service provider. I don't know if we were going to skip over that. I presume so. But that the issue of the definition of security service provider on page 13. Now, if we go back to page 10, there is a definition there of security business. Now, it's very difficult to work out how they differ. The one on page 10 versus the one on page 13.
Respond to that?
For example, the one on page 10, you will see that security business means any person. In other words, that could be a natural person, or it could be a business, a company, etc. A security officer can only be a natural person. In other words, it's the officer who might be employed by a security business, etc. I think that is basically the difference between the two, Chair.
Sorry, I was referring to security service provider means a person who renders a security service to another for remuneration versus security business, any person who renders a security service to another for remuneration. So that's on page 10, security business definition, page 13, security service provider definition. They seem to say the same thing, more or less.
But once again, the security service provider can also be a natural person or a company, whilst the security business is also the same type of entity, can also be a natural person or a company.
The member's question is it not a duplication? Should we refer to security service provider and the security business? That's the question.
If you look at page 13 at the definition of security service provider, it says it means person who renders a security service to another for remuneration, reward, fee or benefit, and includes such a person who is not registered as required in terms of this Act. So it is to cover that eventuality, Chair.
Can we just take the A out before remuneration as well, please? For remuneration. Okay, can we continue?
Chair, on page 14, you will notice the subsection 2, just for chapter 2, we have marked that in red and in square brackets. Previously, it was deleted in the previous text, but it is a deletion from this bill. So when we referred to it in the final text of the bill, it will be marked in square brackets as we've done here. Chair, on page 15...
on page 14, what do you do? Why are you stipulating where the head office is going to be?
Is there a reason for that?
Presently, I think the head office of the authorities in Centurion, we have marked this. We propose that it can actually be deleted. It need not be stated where exactly it should be. If one look at the bigger city complex, it might create actually a problem. So our proposal is that we delete Pretoria there.
Delete two.
Yeah, we can delete all two, that's right, Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Three, on page 15, the primary objects of the authority are to regulate the private security industry and to exercise effective control over the practice of the occupation of security service providing the public and national interest, and for that purpose, subject to this Act 2. And then, Chair, in terms of the reformulation, we propose that that whole part be deleted and that we insert A, ensure, that's on page 16, Chair, after the square brackets, A, ensure a legitimate private security industry which, one, acts in terms of the principles contained in the Constitution and other applicable law, two, is characterized by accessibility, accountability, transparency, equity, professionalism and stability, and three, protects and serves the interests of members of the public who use or are affected by security service. B, determine and enforce minimum standards of occupational conduct in respect of security service providers. C, ensure that the process of registration of security service providers is transparent, fair, objective, and concluded timely. D, promote high standards in the training of security service providers and prospective security service providers. E, promote protection and enforcement of the rights of security officers and other employees in the private security industry. F, ensure that compliance with existing legislation by security service providers is being promoted and controlled through a process of active monitoring and investigation of the affairs of security service providers. G, promote the empowerment and advancement of persons who were historically disadvantaged through unfair discrimination in security, private security industry by encouraging Roman I, ownership and control of security business by such persons, and two, equal opportunity employment practices in the private security industry, and H, promote awareness amongst the public and the private security industry on the functions and role of the authority and industry.
I've got also got a couple, Honourable Stuwa, Honourable Kulabat, Honourable Mulabatsi, Honourable Sabia, Honourable Ndlovu, in that order, please.
Chair, presumably the three will now become two then, seeing that we've deleted two, but with it, on page 15, the primary object of the authority are to regulate the private security industry and to exercise effective control over the practice of the occupation of security services provided in the public of national interest. Now that national interest, don't we need to put it in the definition? Because it was used in the Protection of Information Bill, and I think we should just put that in the definition. Thank you.
And you take that just in cognizance and come back to us on that issue, because there is now, as far as I know, a definition. But can we look at that and come back to us on it? Ms. Kulabana?
Yes, in reference to the phrase, historically disadvantaged through unfair discrimination, in the Legal Practice Bill, that phrase was replaced with the phrase broadly representative, and that was passed in that bill. I don't know that we should pull it into line with the legal practices bill and use that phrase instead.
Ms. Mulabatsi?
Thank you, Chair. Page 17 on the Birla H, at the end of the sentence, authority and the industry, to be authority in the industry. In the top end. Thank you.
Ms. Subiya?
Thanks, Ms. Subiya. I'd like to know, page 17, does the CIRA expected to carry the cost of this awareness campaign?
No, Jefferson, I want to understand G. Does the G does not reflect on the which this bill on trade and industry? Huh? G B E E.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to get it. I'm trying to get the understanding of this of G with the B E E bill from in trade and industry. Does it reflect the same or does it see a different thing?
I also, but you want to respond to those first. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I will note the issue about the national interest. Chair, about the numbering, if we delete subsection 2, it will just be indicated as a deletion because it is an amendment to the Act. In the Act, it will, at the end of the day, reflect it as a deletion. Chair, the issue of paragraph G, I think we recognize that it's being reflected also in other legislation, the BE legislation as well as the employment equity legislation. I think what we did here was to really reflect the gist of that legislation, etc. I personally think that to repeat it here doesn't do any damage, but it's a policy decision whether one wants to repeat it here, because if that legislation it might be changed, it might need a change in this legislation as well. And the general legislation on employment equity, etc., is generally applicable in civil service and elsewhere in business as well. So I think it's a really a policy decision on whether we also want to reflect it here in this bill.
Honourable Global, just on this issue, I see there's answer. Honourable Global and Honourable Global, just on this specific issue, please.
No, Jefferson. You see now, I think Jacobs has already quoted two bills, two acts, which is the BEE and equity bill. Here, we are talking about those acts. What I'm trying to say is that if those acts are amended, that means we are forced to amend this act. My understanding, in all this bill, look, you don't refer to the act as such, in explanatory note, like this one, when you quote the other areas. But this one, you quote as a verbatim. Why is there a difference?
Chair, could I also put, if I put mine as well, then if you could answer at the same time. I just got the exact phrase from the legal practices bill, and it's quite elegantly said. It says broadly representative of the republic demographics. And I think that you know, referring to historically disadvantaged is almost past its sell-by date. So I don't know that it's broadly representative of the public demographic as used in that or may not be more suitable here.
Can I just come in on that issue as well? I think the crux of the matter is, can we not refer to the relevant legislation? I think that's what the Honourable Law was also saying. Because, I mean, I'm not necessarily in agreement with Honourable Pulavana's statement that it's past its sell-by date. You know, that's a difference of opinion in terms of politics. But I think the point is the way it's drafted here is very wide. And should we not look at referring to the relevant acts rather than trying to define it? You can respond to those issues, please.
Thanks, Chair. I think what G does is to establish the principle in terms of promoting the empowerment. If you look at sub 1, ownership and control, by referring to specific legislation, it might be limiting in terms of causing an amendment. So we can look at the principle and refer to applicable legislation without specifying the legislation itself. But the principle is to empower, is to promote that empowerment and related to disadvantagement. I think we can look at the wording, but the principle is very clear.
Like law advisors, you had your hand up as well.
Thanks, Chair. I was just going to differentiate three chapters in what the Honourable Colabana was referring to. You see, the issue of broadly representative chapters would be more relevant where you're talking about membership or the constitution of boards and councils and bodies like that chapters. Here you're talking about issues of ownership and control, so you cannot be able to deal with them in terms of democracy, of democracy in ownership of businesses. Thanks.
Can I ask that instead of us spending more time on this issue now, that you go and look at the principle as addressed and come back to us and give us a solution to this issue? The principle as addressed by the Honourable Ndlovu and myself on that issue. Can you then also respond on the
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, we have noted the proposal of the Honourable Malabatsi on changing the A to E, and then relating the cost.
How did it, do you agree with it?
We agree, Chair. Yeah. Chair, the issue of costs, yes, I think this is only for the account of CIRA to do this type of public awareness.
I have two more issues on this one. I think if you look at D, what is missing for me is that one wants to see uniform standards of training. And I don't know whether we shouldn't look at, CIRA should establish, promote high, minimum, whatever, what you call high uniform standards in the training of security service providers to protect security service providers. The argument I'm making is, if we don't have a measurement, then company A, that's a security trainer, can register on the least possible criteria. Company Y can register on the top kind of criteria. So there should be some form of a minimum standard, but not losing the high that you're referring to, if you understand what I'm getting at. So that's the one thing that I think that needs a bit of redrafting there. The second thing is that I'm missing throughout this list reference to ethical practice by security service providers. And I think it would be good if we can add another one in terms of ethical practices. You can come back to us on those issues. If you disagree, please indicate so.
What are we removing?
No, we're not removing anything. What I've asked on a...
No, in each.
The and is substituted. The and, the industry, is substituted with E. With the word E. Role of the authority in the industry. Because it's not CIRA's responsibility to promote the industry. It's CIRA's responsibility to promote its own work within the industry. Okay. Are we satisfied with that section then? And you will come back to us on the redrafts of those. Okay. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. Question 17, the functions of the authority. I will start right at the sketch. Chair, you will recall that there were two options here. We reflected the preferred option. It looks a bit different because we have done it in terms of the bill and how it must be drafted at the end of the day. So we've indicated with deletions and insertions. Chair 4 then reads, the authority must take steps to achieve its objects with the means at its disposal and may subject to this act and any other law for the purpose of achieving its objects, A, exercise such powers and perform such duties as may be given or assigned to the authority in terms of this act, or any other law, B, inquire into and report to the minister on any matter concerning the objects of the authority, C, C, advise the minister on any matter deemed by the authority to be necessary or expedient to be considered by the minister in connection with the provisions of this act or the Levies Act or the application thereof, and on any other matter relating to security services which has been referred by the minister to the authority for the advice and recommendations of the authority. D, conduct an ongoing study and investigation of the rendering of security services and practices of security service providers in order to identify shortcomings in this Act and the Levies Act or any policy or rule made in terms thereof, and to deal with any evasion, abuse or violation of procedures or principles contained in this Act or the Levies Act or any policy or rule made in terms thereof. Chair, then from paragraph E to for the next few pages until page 22, the existing, to the bottom of page 21, that is all deleted from the present text, and it is substituted by the following, and that starts on page 22E. Receive and consider applications for registration and renewal of registration as security service provider, and grant or renew registration to applicants who comply with the requirements of such registration or renewal of registration in terms of this Act. If establish and manage branch offices.
Let me finish the section, we'll come back to it.
Chair, the existing Act refers to branch offices. We might need to refer to something like provincial offices. G, provide or disseminate information promoting and encouraging compliance with this Act, the Levies Act and the Code of Conduct by security service providers. H, provide information to the users, prospective users or representative of users of security services regarding the compliance of security service providers with the provisions of this Act and the Levies Act. I, in the prescribed manner, establish a complaints office to receive, process, refer or deal with complaints regarding the quality of service rendered by security service providers. J, determine, charge and collect fees as provided for in this Act or in respect of any service rendered by the authority or any object made available by the authority. K, determine minimum internal control systems for security businesses, including but not limited to accounting and reporting procedures and any other procedures or systems. L, conduct or cause to be conducted hearings, investigations and inquiries with regard to any matter falling within the scope of its functions, and M, enter into agreements with or obtain the assistance of any department or organized state to conduct or assist it in conducting any investigation or performing any other function in terms of this Act or the Levies Act, and lastly, N, generally perform any act that contributes to the attainment of its objects.
Members, I open up the section. Is T ready? Outside. Can I just get it? Is it old tea? Okay. I'm opening up this section for comments. Questions? The Honourable Mzolo started already. Can you highlight that? And then the Honourable Mlabatse.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I just want to highlight F, if it can be rewritten properly, because I don't know what's the meaning of branch offices.
Yeah, I think this is an important issue for the committee that we need to look at. But we also need to look at the financial implications of what we're saying here. That's the other part of it. It's important because of the fact that we have concerns in terms of the servicing of certain provinces. So we need to establish what it is that we're trying to achieve through the bill. Are we saying that there should be a provincial office in every single province? What are we saying? Can we get clarity from you on this issue, please?
It will go further than that, Jefferson, through you, Jefferson. It will go further than that, because if you say provinces will have offices, in the next step, you'll find that provinces want to have their offices too, and then it will be decentralized to where. This is why I'm asking this, so that you will understand it. The financial implication and the understanding of the doctors, or what do they need advice?
Honourable Mlabatse?
Chair, I'm covered by Honorable Nigo. Just to say, my point was also on provincial offices, that it will, the structure will be more clear. Thanks, Chair.
Can you respond to that issue, please?
Chair, if you would allow, I think maybe it's a practical question as well, relating to the authority, how it is structured at the moment. I also prefer provincial office, and I think that is how it is structured at the moment. So from a drafting point of view, we can insert provincial office if that is in line also with the present practice, Chair.
Can I just sit on?
Thank you, Chair. We agree with the proposition for provincial offices. Currently, we do have regional offices, but we're not covering all the provinces. There's currently three provinces that are not covered in the services that we have.
It's more than three. I say there's more than three that are not covered.
Does it mean there are regional offices? There are provincial offices, regional offices. What does that mean?
You see, that's the problem. Are you talking about your current structure about regional offices, or are you talking about provincial offices? You're talking about regional offices, correct?
Referring to regional offices, Chairperson.
No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, do you refer in CIRA itself to regional or provincial offices?
We're referring to regional offices currently.
And that is basically one office per province in those provinces that have offices. Am I correct, or are there more than one office?
In some provinces, like Gauteng, we've got two offices, one in Pretoria, one in Joburg.
You see, that's where my problem comes in, Japan. This is why I'm asking. I know when you talk about region, when you talk about province, I understand that. But I wanted to be clear, if we say provincial offices, you talk about Gauteng or KwaZulu-Natal or whatever. But when you talk about regions, you talk about totally different things from the province. This is why I'm asking the question. So let me elaborate more on this so that you'll understand exactly what they are talking about.
Thank you, Chief.
While it may have cost implications, for me it's also the principle of regulation, that if you are to regulate an industry that is large as private security industry, where your housing office is bigger than your free state office, you should have a provincial footprint, because there is very few provinces that don't have a significant number of security service providers operated, whether they be guards or employees. So for me, there may be cost implications, but this is also a principal issue, that you need to look at your regulation having a provincial footprint.
I don't think we understand each other. What I'm trying to say, Chairperson, when this CIRA is talking about regional offices, the understanding is different than you talk about provincial offices. I don't say they mustn't have regional offices. I'm saying if they say they will have provincial offices, there will be areas where they will have regional offices within the province. That is what I want to know.
That's why I think forget about what CIRA is saying now. The fact is, what do we want? Because we are in the legislation. What we want is to see a provincial footprint in every single province, and not a situation where you have the national office, a Pretoria office and the Joburg office in one province, and then you have four or five other provinces without any footprint. So what do we want to say here? And I think that is what we need to go at. Whether we call it a provincial office or a regional office is actually quite irrelevant. The principle is we want to see that CIRA's got a footprint in every single province. So can we look at if and not maybe look at establish and manage, establish CIRA offices in every single province or something like that. Establish and manage a CIRA office in every province, something like that rather. And then regulation and structure can determine what you call that office. I'm asking members as well. How do you feel about that?
Look, I actually think it's the right way to go. I'm just in that we also said, you know, we look at the business of the head office being in Pretoria, but I see also that the matter that's going to Gauteng and other provinces are being ignored. But should we not? I mean, we could say this and say they should have it in every province, and 50 years down the line there'll still be nothing in certain provinces. So I don't know how quite I get around that, but I'm just saying that that will be an issue because it will be a nice to have as opposed to a directive. Well, it's a directive with no time factor.
The problem is we can't put time frames in the legislation. That's a problem. But it can look into and transitional arrangements. Mr. Sermon?
Thanks, Chair. I was just thinking in terms of alternative construction. Given, obviously, depending on statistics in terms of the number of security officers in the process, maybe we could add where necessary or appropriate.
That's exactly what we want to prevent. That's exactly what we want to prevent, because from the annual report it was clear that some provinces are not receiving the attention that they should be getting. So what we want to see is a footprint in every province. How we word it, we're going to leave up to you. We will come back to it. So just make a note of this issue so that we can come back to it, please. I want you to look at I as well, please. Honourable Lebossi. You covered with this. If we can come to I. I'm worried about... I don't have a problem with what we're trying to attain, but I'm worried about service complaints. Because service complaints should be directed to the company. We don't want a situation where CELA becomes like the ICD used to be, a complaint box. It must deal with the issues that is against the law, behavior by private security companies that is contravening their own regulations, etc., etc. So I'm worried about the use of server complaints. I think we need to define I more narrow, that it still receives complaints, but it's not service complaints. If I've got a problem with the server of the company that I'm using, I complain to the company. But if that company is not arriving the way they're supposed to be arriving, I can see that the security guards are not treated the way they should be treated, or they're using firearms when I know they're not supposed to be using firearms, then I'm not able to complain to CERA. That is what I'm trying to highlight, members. I don't know how you feel about it, members, but I am concerned that it's going to become general complaints. Yeah.
No, I think you're right, Jefferson, because CERA will tend to be a complaint service provider instead of the company who's rendering the service. CERA can't be the service provider, the complainant service provider. The people who are providing the service to you, that should be with their complaint. And if therefore you are not satisfied as a customer, then you can take a further step.
The point is, if I just explain myself further, the point is, this is a free market environment. If I'm not happy with company A services, I will join company Y. CERA's focus must be in terms of a compliance with the Act. So in other words, I ask my security service provider, the guy that's sitting at my gate, can I see your CERA card? And he doesn't have one. Then I complain to CERA and say to CERA, this company that I'm using are using unregistered security guards. Then it becomes a CERA issue. So, for me, I'm really concerned about it. Honourable Philibon, if you wanted to comment on this.
I think the crux of the matter is the three words quality of service. Because that would refer to, the guys were late or there was a problem. What the chair is looking at, I think, is almost criminal behaviour on the part of the company. Their guards are unregistered, they don't have certification, so that sort of issue should certainly come. But I mean, if the guard is 20 minutes late, you don't find serious say a chub guard is late out of my gate, because that's what quality of service means. So I think it's those, that's where focus needs to be. And it's actually breaking off this legislation that needs to be addressed, and so you have to work out how to define that exactly.
So can we ask that you look at that to come back to us on I? I think you get the feeling of the committee is in agreement to that as well, and I don't think that was the intention in any case. But I am worried if we say quality of service, then every person's got their right to complain to CERA about the quality of service, and that's all they're going to receive then.
So can we continue, please? Is there anything else under this list of members that you still want to look at? Can I just ask the team, are you certain that everything is captured here?
Chairperson, what is N stand for?
Page 23.
What does it mean?
Meaning of N.
Chair, I think this is what we call in Afrikaans a Doringdraad clause. It's really not adding much in the sense that whenever the powers, etc., are interpreted by court, if it affects any right, and it's not specifically mentioned, it doesn't have much meaning. But I think it's intended to close a gap. I personally feel it doesn't contribute much to the text.
It's a catch-all. I think it's a catch-all to say that they can do whatever they need to do in terms of this act to execute and to achieve their objects. Correct? Can I just ask you one thing? And I want to take you back to the beginning of this section. And it's something that bothers me throughout this book. 4b. Inquire into and report to the minister on any matter concerning the objects of the authority. Throughout the act, the ball, there is a blurring of lines between the authority reporting to the minister or the council reporting to the minister. And I think it needs to be corrected. We need to be clear on what it's going to be. The authority reports to the minister through the council. And I think that's what needs to be clarified as well. The authority can't report to the minister directly. Unless we do away with the council, then it becomes like, but then it becomes more like a department. They're not a public entity. I just want to hear you on that issue, please.
Chair, I'm in agreement. I think also if one look at the issue of accountability, at present the council is accountable. And I think that line of authority should go through the accountable authority in terms of ensuring that you keep your lines intact and that everyone along the line knows where what are issues, etc. Especially to the minister, who must also report to Parliament.
So you can look through, at it throughout the bill, we will highlight where we get to it and where the contradictions are. But I think you, for instance, should then read concerning the objects of authority through the council. Okay. C then also gets affected. D is fine, but C I think also is affected by this. Advise the minister through the council on any matter determined by the authority. Sorry? Sorry, I can't.
If you correct B, C will fall into B, because it can be authority this side and then council at the other side.
So it's not just always saying it's throughout. I'm not going to stop if you repeat it if we get to sections where it needs to be repeated, and that we can highlight it so that we don't miss it, please. So can we continue after this in governance of authority? I think that's where we are currently.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we propose to insert in Section 5, a subsection 2A, the Public Finance Management Act applies to the Council in terms of the whole new disputation, in terms of the financial issues.
Explain to me, what is this whole new dispensation that you're speaking about?
Chair, you will recall that once there were provisions in this act relating to auditing, etc., etc. But once CIRA became a public entity, the Public Finance Management Act automatically became applicable. But that's not reflected in the act at the moment. And I think that's what we're doing here, to align CIRA as a public entity with the Public Finance Management Act and the authority of the Auditor General and all that changes.
I'm asking that question because that's why we wanted you when you started to report back, because one of the issues was in the introduced bill, And Treasury then indicated they were not consulted on it and they made an agreement with it. It was suggested in the introduced bill that they become a cost center of government. You would remember a separate vote, etc. So we're not going to go that route. Am I correct, Secretary? Can I hear you?
Chair, we had quite a lot of discussion on that. We have looked at the Public Price Management Act in terms of entities, and entities, we've got a clause in the bill that addresses that, but not in the way which it was first introduced, which basically, you see, under the Public Finance Management Act, entities can only borrow from the state, so they have to pay it back. So when we look at that clause on funding, we put in a clause, which we'll come to just now, which actually doesn't make it basically doesn't make it a borrowing, but it also doesn't make it a requirement for Treasury to fund. But it doesn't close the possibility that going forward, if the industry, for example, boycotted, that Treasury couldn't step in. So we've written that clause in such a way. We did send that clause after the consultation processes back to National Treasury. So we'll come to that clause specifically.
I want to understand, Secretary, it's a simple question. It's no longer a separate vote, as was introduced.
Not as it's written in the bill.
Thank you. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. Subsection.
Sorry, Honourable Kudo.
Sorry, just before we move on, can you just. 5.2. I've read it a number of times, and it seems quite a bizarre sentence. Could you just unpack it for me, please?
Yeah, let me just finish. Fast, if you don't mind, then we will come.
Thank you, Chair. Sub 4, the authority must otherwise perform its functions in terms of this Act, the Levies Act, and we have inserted and Public Finance Management Act, and in accordance with such guidelines and policy directions as may be issued by the Minister from time to time in the Gazette. A new subsection 6 is inserted whenever members of the Council are unable to agree on a material, financial, governance or operational issue which cannot be resolved by the Council. The Minister must mediate between the parties.
Okay, let's start with 5.2 then, Honourable Klebana.
Yeah, I mean, the authority acts of the Council and acts of the Council are regarded as acts of the authority. It's an interesting sentence.
Chair, the authority, or the Council is the accounting institution or the accounting body for the South Sea. And also in terms of court cases, etc., when the Council is cited, it will be regarded as the authority that's also been cited, because the Council remains accountable for all the actions of the authority as well, because of that accountability requirement.
Can I ask you a question? And I'm asking this question, members, because we've still got to apply our minds on the Council itself as well. Is there an example that you can give us in terms of public entities where Council is not the accounting authority? If you can't give us the answer now, I would like you to go and look at that, please.
Another phrase I found a bit odd was in number 5.4, where it says that the Minister may issue guidelines and policy directions. Surely the Minister issues regulations, his department does regulations, but does not issue policy directions.
Ministers issue policy directions, but they also do regulations. Ministers do issue policy regulations. That's the prerogative of executives. But I think it's very clunky written, quite honestly. Because 4 and 5 almost seems the last part of 4 and 5 almost seem to be a repetition. No. So I don't know whether we can say 4, though, consider please to have 4 referring simply to the financial aspects of it. And 5 referring to the guidelines and policy directions of Minister and the publisher thereof in the Gazette. So if that is possible, we can do that. So the appointment otherwise perform its functions in terms of this Act, the Levies Act and the Public Finance Management Act. A guide and a policy direction issued by the Minister. Then you can say the Minister may issue guidelines and policy directions and must be published amended, withdrawn, or substituted by notice in the Gazette as fine. Does it make sense?
Yeah, I think the present construction is just simply to provide in sub 5 that policy directions of the Minister may be amended. I think that's the only reason for sub 5 at the moment.
We don't mind 5. We think 4, the last one of 4 is misplaced. What we're suggesting is that you combine, that you stop at the Public Finance Management Act, full stop, and then 5 address the issue of policy directions, withdrawal thereof, amendments thereof, etc., in 1. Can you look at that for us, please? Can we continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. On page 24, section 6, we've inserted a 1 there because of the subsection 2 that's included. And then subsection 2 reads, in the appointment of members of the council, consideration must be given to appointing persons who have amongst them knowledge and experience in respect of at least finance, law and governance. Chair, we followed here more or less the construction we used in the DPCI legislation. And we have changed the wording a bit, as it was.
We're not happy with your changes here, because you totally ignored what we said, completely. We made it very, very clear that we want at least one of the councillors to have finance skills. We want one of the councillors to have governance skills, another that have law, skills law. That's what we said, not what two is saying.
Jim, we have shifted the at least that it's still there in the point knowledge and experience in respect of at least finance, law and governance.
That could be one person that claims I have all of this, and we don't want that. And it also said consideration must be given. We're not giving an option to the minister here. We're making it clear what we want in the council. As the people drafting the legislation, we are saying that we want a chairperson, vice chairperson, 3 additional councillors, of which they must have the following skills. No consideration given. Can we get that 3 drafted as well, please? Continue then. Is there anything else in this section, members?
Chair, 6A, page 24, a new insertion, requirements for appointment as councillor. A member of the council for the authority must be a fit and proper person with due regard to his or her experience, conscientiousness and integrity, to be entrusted with the responsibilities of the office concerned.
What does that mean? Conscientiousness, for instance, is part of it not to be at the annual report hearings of Parliament, since you're the accounting authority. I wonder how it even reaches the legislation. That's what I'm asking.
I'm not sure why it reaches the legislation. We put this into various pieces of legislation so that if you have an appointment of somebody, it does make that appointment more challengeable. So we put similar wording into the DPCI legislation in terms of the appointment of the head. I'm not sure about the conscientiousness, but in terms of the fit and proper, it is something which you can challenge, which you can contest in terms of the person's ability.
You see, in the DPCI legislation, for instance, we've got certain very specific criteria. No criminal record, etc., etc. Is this not where we should be going in terms of this, rather? That we be more specific in terms of the type of counsellor that we're looking for? I'm asking, I'm not saying it must be the way, I'm also asking the question to members.
Yes, we want to take us out from here. from this paragraph is this conscientiousness, which we really don't understand, take us the whole system out of this paragraph. I maybe try that to bring the CI the paragraph here, because that one is very clear in what is here.
Yes, qualifications is addressing some of these issues. But I know what you're saying, Sixby. I don't have a problem with what you're saying. All I'm saying is, I think your point is, this is, for instance, that what the section that was used by the Freedom Under Law in challenging the previous head of National Prosecutor's appointment, if I'm not mistaken, was the same sort of provision. State law advisor, am I correct? It's the same sort of provision. So it's not invaluable. There is value to it. That's why I've asked, can you just tell us how it enriches it? And maybe members, if I say that, are we satisfied that it stays? Satisfied that it's safe? Can I get an indication from members? Satisfied? Satisfied that it's safe? What I'm saying, Honourable, yeah. Look, what I'm saying is, this is the same, that's what we're indicating, provision that was used by, for instance, by the Freedom, I think it was Freedom Under Law. That challenges the appointment of the previous head of public prosecutions. Was this type of provision. So by saying that, I'm questioning myself in terms of my criticism, whether it does not have the value that the technical team is proposing. And can we consider that?
How did you define the DPCI?
Same, it's more or less the same.
But you didn't use consciousness?
The exact wording.
Can I just explain, if somebody has had a history of non-performance in an entity or an organisation and their personnel records show that non-performance, conscientiousness can be challenged based on those records.
Let's keep this section. I don't think it's doing any harm. Let's look at the rest of it and then we can continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. 7 on page 24. There's qualifications for appointment as counsellor. A person may not be appointed as a counsellor if such person, A, is not a citizen of the Republic, chair was deleted there, or does not have permanent resident status in. There we have discussed this issue at length with the state law advisors as well, and we feel this is one of the places where the requirement or the exclusion or does not have the permanent resident status where it can actually be deleted, chair, in terms of national interest and all that type of things. Chair, then C on page 25 is deleted. The reason for that is that we are now saying in 6A, a member of the council for the authority must be a fit and proper person. So that is just deleted in this part. Then, 8.
Can we just go to 7? I see where our hands, Ms. Ulubona.
Yeah, could you just clarify that? What you've just said is that a permanent resident can be a threat to the national interest. Now, if that person is a threat to the country, they shouldn't be a permanent resident in the country. But they're allowed here, they live here, they work here. And as far as I understand it, in the Constitution, it says a permanent resident may do any job in the country. So this actually may put us into the position of being in some way challenged. And that is absolutely the last thing we need is another challenge. So could you work back through that one again? I'm not sure why you removed that.
Can I also use the state law advisors on that, because you did say you had a long discussion with him on this issue as well.
Chair, I'll kick off and I can just come in. If you put the example, Chair, of the head of the DCI, It is a very sensitive post in terms of security. Terrorism cases will be investigated, organized crime, etc., etc. And there we also said that the person must be a citizen of the Republic. And exactly that same argument that we follow in this regard in terms of a council for security officers' council.
So,
in our discussion, I think the main consideration was with respect to the registration of security service providers, which also require that people be residents, people be citizenship person. So it was an alignment with that.
No. Hey, that's not what we're talking about, please.
Can I just clarify, there is a difference for us in what are the requirements for a council member and what are the requirements to be part of the industry. And I think the issue that General Jacobs is raising is that we've done this in other pieces of legislation. We want this council to actually have our country's national interests and be able to deal with high sensitive information. And we've done it in terms of other legislation. It doesn't affect the industry itself, it only affects the council members and, yeah.
Rivers, I personally don't have a problem with this because I don't think it's an unfair requirement. This person is representing government interests. That's the bottom line. And we had this discussion yesterday as well on this issue. We were in general agreement on it. So let's leave it as is currently. We will come back later. If somebody wants to argue their point at some point, they're more than welcome to do so. Continue. Are we satisfied, members, that what is here has a direct or indirect financial or personal interest in the private security industry, or represents or is a member of a body representing the interests of employers or employees, the private security industry or security officers or any security business, is rehabilitated insolvent, has not obtained such a security clearance by national intelligence agency as may have been determined by the minister. What about criminal record?
Chair, we had a lot more in there to disqualify under a lot of legislation. I mean, where's the criminal record? When we had two heads of this entity who were found to have criminal records, they chose that one, put another one in, also had a criminal record. So it's got to be in there.
I know that it's discovered with security clearance well, but I don't think there's any harm in stating it up front. Because you're not stating it up front, the person will come back and say, hey, you didn't tell me that I shouldn't have a criminal record.
Thank you,
Chair.
We're going to include that criminal record, then maybe we also need to include verification of qualifications, because that also
comes. But that's the point. We see there were a lot more under this. And what qualifications it was, criminal record, etc. And I think we need to tighten up this section. On the not having an interest in the private security industry, because I mean there's a conflict of interest completely, and then Commissioner Jacobs will be moving back to self-regulating if we start doing that. But surely we must look at qualifications. We know that is a problem. We must look at criminal record, and if there's anything else.
One may also perhaps look and see if the person has pending charges that are seen as a prima facie case by the NDA.
Yeah. So can you just look at those and then we can just sharpen up on that section. Continue with Ike, please.
Thank you, Chair. The terms, conditions of office, vacation of office and payment of remuneration and allowances. 8.1, it's a change to that subsection. A councillor is subject to the section, appointed for a period not exceeding, we take out 3 years, now 5 years, on such terms and conditions as the minister may determine in a letter of appointment, and then a proviso provided that all members of the council serve on a part-time basis. Subsection 2. A councillor is eligible for reappointment upon the expiry of his or her term of office for a period not exceeding one additional term if he or she continues to meet the requirements for such appointment in terms of this Act. Then in sub 3 chair, we have removed the or after paragraph C. And inserted after paragraph E, and then a new paragraph E inserted. He or she is no longer a fit and proper person as required in section 6A. And 3A, when a counselor becomes subject to any disqualification referred in section 7 or is absent from 3 consecutive meetings of the council, the chairperson, vice chairperson, or acting chairperson contemplated in section 12.10, as the case may be, must inform the minister in writing within a reasonable time, but before the next meeting of council, of such disqualification or absence. 4 and 5 remains presently as they are, chair, and then sub 6 is inserted. A councillor or a member of the committee appointed by the council, referred to in section 31, who is not an employee of the authority or an officer or employee in the public service, may be paid from the funds of the authority such remuneration and allowances as the minister may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. And then subsection 7 is deleted, chair.
Can we just go to 5, please? I have a serious problem. I know we haven't raised previously, but looking at it in hindsight. If a councillor holds office, the minister must review regard to such a table within a reasonable time appoint a person to a councillor ceases to hold office. Within a reasonable time appoint a person to fill the vacancy for the unexpired portion of the former council terms of offices. We've got two issues around this one. The first is reasonable time within a period of 6 months. Within a period of 6 months, that's the first problem. And then we do not agree with this unexpired portion. Why would you want to do that? That's the one way of getting continuity. We know how difficult it is to get people to serve on these kinds of councils, especially part-time councils. So why would we want to say, let's say the person ceases to be a councillor in year 4.5, 6 months left, and then the rest, the new person gets appointed for 6 months. Why do we not want that person? What we were discussing yesterday is to say the individual appointments must be separated from the council service. So in other words, a person can get appointed for a 5-year period. It's going to lead to continuity because all your councillors are not going to leave at the same time. Plus, if that simply doesn't make sense, who's going to be willing to serve on the council for 6 months? So we do have a challenge in terms of this. I acknowledge we haven't raised it before, but in discussing it yesterday, it became clear that this is a problem.
Chairman, maybe I understood wrongly that what we are saying here is that the initial period of 3 years is extended to 5 years. And then there can be one additional term. In other words, it brings you to a total of 10 years that a person can actually serve on the council.
I'm talking about 5.
I'm talking about 5. We the person vacates the office. I'm in office. I vacate my the position. But I've still got 9 months left of my 10-year term even. There should be a new contract with a new person. And then we won't come to the 5 year issue as well. Is that not too long?
We
know, but we
could. Is it not too long?
Jay, is there a benchmark on the other, like EG or those who suppose are for 5 years? The problem is that 3 years is also a very short period of time. You just begin to understand the issues and then your turn is starting to expire. So we looked at it in terms of other government boards and processes, and that's why we were looking at 5 years.
I want to hear you on this 5 issue, but I also want to hear you on 5 that I've raised.
Yeah, just to start at the one, that second 5, number 5. I really think that it should end within a 6 month period. Full stop and wipe out the rest of the sentence. I mean, to suggest that you fill a vacancy for 3 months or whatever and somehow start that, then they've got to come back and be re-interviewed and start again for 5 years. It doesn't work for me at all. I absolutely agree with the chair. And if we go back, I do understand the general contract term is a 5 year period. So I understand that, but then you know, are we happy then that an additional term is another 5 years? So you're talking about somebody who's there for 10 years. That suddenly looks very long to me. So I don't know whether the second term should not perhaps be shortened or even disallowed. I think that needs to be discussed.
Honourable Law.
No, I think we agree with that, Chairperson. First, it's correct that there should be a continuity. In other words, a person can't just have 6 months and so on. But when it comes to term of 5 years, I do understand where they're coming from. But it seems as if, I'm not quite sure now, that a person should be able to have a second term. Because if we are looking at 5 years, 5 years is a long time.
We're looking at 10 years, it becomes a very long time.
We're talking about 10 years. We're talking about 10 years.
Ms. Colonna?
Another possibility, I can't remember which legislation I dealt with that in, but it was, they did not allow a consecutive second term, but they did allow them to come back at a later stage after a break of some years, and say you may serve a second term after a five-year break or something, which gives a perspective period. To come back at it, but to allow them to sit for 10 years, considering the history of this entity, I really think that is really pushing it. So I don't know that it shouldn't change to a single five-year term, which may be, but that the understanding that individual could be reconsidered for another five-year term at a later stage, or to be determined whether it's a five-year break or a three-year break, but I think we should determine it in this. That's just a suggestion.
Honourable Molabatsi, I'd end up being Honourable Lefetu, then Honourable Ndlovu.
Thanks, Chair. I align myself to the 3 years. Okay. Thanks, Chair.
Lefetu?
Thanks, Chair. I really think 5 years it's fair. But after 5 years, obviously, there will be an advertisement for the vacancy. And the person with the expertise and what have you, fulfilling the requirement of the advertisement, would be considered. Thanks, Chair.
I would like to agree with the first five, but the second term should be shorter. Should be shorter. Can it? Hold 5 years. Because if it hold 5 years, we're talking about 10 years. Something has to give here. I understand where Member Colabana is coming from. That break is possible and impossible. There are people who will say, I'm not coming back, or I will be coming back in 2 years' time or whatever. But let us think of shortening some of the time, because it's too long. 10 years is too long.
Because I think I think personally that we must try and find the middle ground. I think there is argument in saying that it's got to be a consecutive. They can serve a consecutive term because it's about the continuity that we talk about. That's where continuity comes in. And that's where I've got a problem in this one in terms of a break and then come back, because it's not going to serve the continuity. But I also believe the 5 years is extremely long. For 2 terms, 10 years, and it's not a full-time position. None of the councillors, according to this now, a full-time position. So I'm wondering whether we can't find each other in a 4-year term, not exceeding 4 years. So if a minister is unhappy about, remember that I didn't say the minister must appoint the person for a 4-year period. It can be a 3-year period, but it can't exceed 4 years. And then have a second term of 4 years thereafter, which is an 8-year period, which I'm still a bit uncomfortable with. I'm not honest. But maybe what we also need to do means to divorce ourselves from history and focus on going forward. Secretary?
I mean, there's pros and cons with both. I think what the chair was saying about divorcing with history. I mean, you could have a finance expertise person that you've appointed to council, who is an expert in public entity finance and as a half-time councillor, and it would be a pity to lose that expertise just because their term of office was up. But on the other hand, you're also talking about an industry that is very pervasive and actually has the ability to buy people off. So I think that there's a key to not have somebody serve a consecutive term, even if it means that the minister has to shorten the second term, because in terms of the chairperson is saying the act says not exceeding 5 years. So you could say, on condition that this consecutive term is not more than 2 years, so that you allow for some continuity from council to council. You don't always have a brand new council.
Yeah, can you the technical team look at this? Because I think that the suggestion that the secretariat is now making, is maybe the rule to go. A period not exceeding 5 years, a second term of which the joint period cannot be longer than 7 years. So the first and the second term cannot be longer than 7 years, jointly. So if the first term was 5 years, the second term can only be 2 years. If the first term was 4 years, the second term can be 3 years. Because that then gives the minister an opportunity to start saying to one of the other councillors or the vice chairperson, you're going to take over, so start preparing yourself for whatever the case may be. It gives a bit of continuity. It then addresses Honourable Philip Barnes' concern about a great type of thing as well. You're not giving a 10-year-long issue. So let them look at it and come back to us. They've heard us on this issue. And come back to us on this issue.
Thank you, Chair. Section 8 of page 26. The Council must take steps to achieve the object of the authority. B, must oversee and exercise general control over the performance. C, may by notice and gazette make a rule subject to the provisions of this Act and the Less Act. The good management of the affairs of the Council and effective execution of its functions. Chair, I go to subsection 2, the chairperson, and we have deleted may subject to ratification by council exercise any power of the council or fulfill any of its duties. It was a long discussion in the committee and it was decided that it's an unhealthy situation that must be rectified. Then if chair was changed, must maintain a working relationship with the civilian secretariat to cooperate on policing and policy matters related to the private security industry.
Okay. Can I just hear from the lady who are a key reading? Thank you very much. I'm going to suggest that we take a break here, we come back and we will discuss that because we have some issues around
here as well.
Thanks. Mavis, it's just after 1:45, can we be back at 11 o'clock please?
If you can, but otherwise if you can't then you need to inform about it. Yeah. But I think also this double day when not a meeting occurs after lunch. Yeah. I mean when it's tea I usually use the NPC line. But I'll use the short one at lunch when the meeting's done. But is there any other person?
I hope I don't get thrown into anything like that.
Well, I think the essence is more to on a summary. No. Yeah. And that was easy because it was just adoption of committee meeting. So then all they do is it's at the same process, showing through the chat page, but then they're just noting like grammatical errors or something. And then that's like it. So then all you'll say is the committee went through the minutes page by page, and then there's grammatical errors to be amended. Mm-hmm. And then it's just then you just write that it's just adopted. Yeah, that's all. And that was a short meeting, so it was a good one. But I think the best thing is to look in your manual and highlight all the different types of meetings. Mm-hmm. So there's the deliberations, and then you also get briefings by the department, discussion of reports and minutes and stuff. And then just to look, what does it say? Yeah, in your agenda, it tells you, what kind of meeting it is, that's consideration. And then to go onto the PMB website and pick out examples in each one. Mm. And then just follow that kind of format, yeah. Yeah, I think that's what it is. Mm.
Yeah.
No, it's just when we came in, just off that door, it's right. So
clarity on this issue, especially in light of the fact that we don't no longer have full-time chairperson. Can you just speak to those, please?
Thank you, Chair. Regarding C, I notice in the Gazette make rules subject to the provisions of this Act, it's a minister, regarding the good management of the affairs of the Council and effective execution of functions and any matter necessary to expedient. Chair, I think this relates also to the previous one we discussed, the powers of the minister, because the minister is towards Parliament has a responsibility in terms of the Act. And I think this is to contribute also to the manner in which the broader management of the authority is being done in terms of the Council's responsibility.
Sorry, can I just interrupt? Should the PFMI not also be included there? This Act, the Levies Act, and the PFMI.
I agree with that, Chair. Chair, regarding D and E, I think we are in agreement, it's present wording of the Act, but I also have a bit of a difficulty with the chairperson providing strategic direction. It should actually be the whole council. And also to attend the meetings of the senior management, I think the director is actually also, he can be called in by the council, etc. So I think that D and E should actually be removed, Chair.
So we just spoke about D. When we, let's talk about two in totality. E, I think we're all in agreement, must be removed. We agree with that one. D, I think there's value in it being there. But because your chairperson must prepare the agenda of the council and the final minutes of the council and must provide strategic direction to the authority through the council and not the director, to the authority through the council. Because then I think we address your concern, Mr. Jacobs, as well, that it's the council that is ultimately responsible, but you're not making a group of people responsible, you're making the chair of that responsibility. Authority through the council. Are we happy with that, members? And E, we then remove. Okay, F, we're happy with that, clear. Can we then move to 28?
Thank you, Chair. Accountability of the Council. 10.1, the Council is accountable to the Minister for the performance of its functions and must...
Sorry, Chairperson, we remove F.
Sorry?
Say about F.
No, we agree with F. E, we remove. We remove E, but we are in agreement with F.
Chair, 10.1, the Council is accountable to the Minister for the performance of its functions and must supply the Minister with such information and particulars as the Minister may in writing require in connection with the functions of the authority or any other matter relating to the authority. Sub B, 1, 2, 3 and C is deleted. And then a new subsection 1A is inserted, Chair, to read, the Council must submit a report to the Minister, A, on any matter required by the Minister under subsection 1, and on any matter which is necessary or expedient to bring to the attention of the Minister, and B, at least once a quarter in connection with the activities of the authority, including Roman 1, the number of security service providers registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended, dormant, merged, deaccredited, and prosecuted. 2, the number of security officers registered, including category and functions. 3, the details of training undertaken by registered security officers and training institutions. 4, the number of training institutions registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended, and dormant. 5, the number of firearms registered to, lost by, stolen from, transferred by security business or destroyed in terms of the Firearms Control Act 2000, Act No. 60 of 2000. Chair, we have changed that a bit because the authority cannot itself, or no security service provider can destroy firearms, but they might be destroyed in terms of the Firearms Control Act when they are handed over to the police for that. 6 instances in which firearms were discharged by a security officer in the performance of his or her duties causing death or injury. 7 information of criminal complaints relating to security service providers reported to the security service by the authority. And 8 a report in terms of the Public Finance Management Act to the minister. And then the proposal is that subsection 2 be deleted, Chair.
Can we talk about the section members, anything under this section? Can we go to Roman 7 on page 29? We discussed this issue yesterday as well. Information of criminal complaints. Now, there's a difference between criminal complaints and criminal investigations. So we're suggesting that it be criminal investigations because all complaints are not going to lead to investigations. A complaint might be registered, might be found to be unsubstantiated. And therefore, we were suggesting that we want to hear you on it, that it should rather be information of criminal investigations relating to security service providers reported to the service, which is the SPS, by the authority. Secretary?
Yeah, I know what the committee is saying, but could we not look at complaints and investigations? Because it is a problem with complaints not being properly investigated. So if you look at complaints and investigations, the authority can say this is the number of complaints, but this is the number of times there were investigations instituted.
That's fine. I think we want to capture the investigation part of it as well. Honorable Mullabasi?
Okay. Are we now going to say complaints and investigations? All right. Thank you.
And then can we look at it as well? We said from our own notes as well, a mandatory report in terms of the public finance management back to the minister, because that's required of every single entity, so it must be a mandatory report.
If we're going to define it as monthly, can we not say monthly and quarterly, because the PFMA requires two types of reports, monthly and quarterly.
Yep. Monthly and quarterly reports in terms of the PMA to the minister. 2, we then agreement, we drop that. Okay, let's move to page 30.
Okay, Chair, ministerial supervision of authority. 11, if the council or the authority cannot or does not maintain an acceptable standard in the fulfillment of one or more of its functions in terms of this act, of the Levies Act and the Public Finance Management Act, the Minister may intervene by taking any appropriate step to ensure proper fulfillment of that function, including, and then Chair, we have just deleted in after B and then inserted after G, after C, taking such corrective measures as required by the circumstances in the period whilst there is no appointed counsel, and E, the intimate appointment of a person or persons meeting the requirements contemplated in Section 6A to ensure the continuity of the affairs of the authority, provided that the interim appointment may not exceed 6 months. So I think we've already discussed this morning as well the continuity of the affairs, and this is just a temporary measure to ensure that there is continuity whilst the proper appointment is being made.
Can I just ask for clarity? Issuing a directive to the council or the authority? Again, for me, it's this double. Now, there might be a situation where you don't have a council. So, before you agree with me, because we also make provision for if he decides to get rid of the council. But for me, it's again this double talk about who actually. Issuing a directive to the council, all the authorities, examining the extent of the failure and stating the steps required to remedy the situation. To the council, and in the absence of a council, to the authority. Is that not what we should be saying, Secretary?
If we remove the authority, doesn't D take that into, doesn't D deal with your question? The new D taking such corrective measures as required by the circumstances in the period while there is no council.
I think it's two different things. The one is issue a directive to the council through the authority. Issue a directive to the council. I don't know. I'm not sure about this. It doesn't make complete sense. Can I hear psychological advice that we've got an opinion on this?
Yeah,
Chair, I think you are correct in saying where there is no council, then the directive should be issued to the authority. I think it would be much better in that way.
What I'm asking is, shouldn't it be issuing a directive to the authority through the council, describing the extent of failure and taking the steps required to remedy the situation? Then addresses the issue of if there's no council. So when there's a council, it should be issuing a directive to the authority through the council, describing the extent of failure and taking the steps required to remedy the situation. Or are we being too bureaucratic? Accounting officers told the council. Are you in agreement with that? Minister, are you satisfied with that?
Minister, speak through the council, to the authority.
And if there's no council, D comes into play. Happy with that? Can I hear the team, the technical team?
We support that change.
The rest of the session members, are you satisfied? Okay, continue then.
Chair, section 12 on page 31, meetings and conflict of interest. Chair, we have inserted paragraph C, the council must meet at least once every quarter. We have taken into account the concern that there might be, if we say only four per year, it might be three meetings in one quarter and then no other meetings. 2A, the chairperson.
Can we go back to what the authority must report on and the council must report on? I think it's important that the council also report on the meetings. Number of meetings. I know for a fact that that is what Honourable Ndlovu, you might have helped me. Onscore, in their annual report, must report on the number of meetings that help people that have attended, council members that have attended the council meeting, as well as the witness of that meeting. So if we can add that to the previous part of that we've already got to as well. Sorry that I'm interrupting you, but I'm worried that I forget it. I think it's also control for oversight.
J2A, the chairperson may at any time convene a special meeting of council and must also convene such a meeting if so directed by the minister in writing.
It stays the same. Can I hear members on this page? We will go to the next one. Are we satisfied with that? We are. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. Then just the deletion in subsection 7 of paragraph D, the fact that the Councillor is guilty of an act or omission justifying his or her removal from office. Maybe just for the context, Chair, I'll just read it. The decision taken by the Councillor or an act performed in terms of the decision is not invalid merely by reason of any irregularity in the appointment of a councillor, a vacancy on the council, or the fact that any person was not entitled to sit as a councillor at the time the decision was taken, and what we have defeated, the fact that the councillor is guilty of an act or omission justifying his or her removal from office. If such decision was taken by a majority of councillors present at the time and entitled so to sit, and those councillors at the time constituted a quorum in terms of subsection 3. Chair, you will recall there was quite a long discussion on this, and we have looked at other pieces of legislation and compared them, and this G was not present in some of the other, or most of the other provisions we looked at, and that is the reason why we say that we propose that D should be deleted.
Can I hear me, Ms. Miss?
Could just, because it doesn't exist in other legislation, I don't think that precludes us from leaving it in. Because if a councillor is guilty of an act of omission, in that they have the knowledge of something that they should reveal, surely then that the council should be able to speak to that. So I'm not too sure why you're removing it, just because it's not in the legislation.
In response to that?
Chair, I think that C covers all that eventuality anyway. So the reason why we take it out is that we didn't think it was necessary to have this clause when it's on other pieces, but C covers that. Say a councillor has criminal conviction and doesn't disclose it, it comes out afterwards, it doesn't mean that council's decision was wrong. It's already covered in C. But
are we not being too lenient? Not by removing that, but by these provisions.
Chair, I think it also relates to, if I could say, a type of continuity as well, especially where the council is challenged. And for instance, the council might not have known that the council had guilty of an act, or there might still be a process that might unfold, and now it actually taints all the decisions taken by the council. So I think this is just a type of a provision, because I mean, if a decision was taken that was malafide, or there's some legal ground why it's not legal, I think this was to cover a situation where actually the rest of the council and the minister is not aware of the situation, that to keep the integrity of the decisions taken in the meantime.
The chairman just said, oh, we're not being too lenient. Right, let's say a person's come along, they say, oh, I have a doctorate, I'm brilliant, I'm a genius. They go through the interviews they get on as a counselor, they now received a salary for 3 years, and only then is it revealed that, as seems to be the favourite trick these days, they lie through their teeth about the educational qualifications. Now that means they're simply disqualified. But actually what they've committed here is fraud. Now, is there some sort of, I haven't seen it, but, you know, I was going to say, oh, you can't be an member. But actually what they're guilty of is stealing for 3 years. So what is the follow-up on this?
Yeah, before you respond to it, there's also for me an issue in terms of three. The quorum for any meeting of the council is simple majority of the councillors in office at the time. Now, at some point last year, we had three councillors. So two people take the decision. Yes. The quorum for any meeting of the council is a simple majority of the councillors in office at the time. And I think here we must, because that would also put pressure on the executive to appoint councillors in time, is that we must say here, a simple majority of the councillors in office at some, provided that it is always, well, what are we talking about, five councillors? Two people can take a decision. That's the problem here.
Maybe it was just before getting to that question, because maybe the way to resolve that is not in office at time. It's a simple quorum of at least three people. So that even if you have two vacancies, all three must sit and make that decision for the month or however many months that it is. So maybe it's not a quorum of those in office, it's a quorum of three people. So that it does away with that. With the issues that were being raised on this Colabana, I hear what you're saying, and maybe there is provision somewhere else in the Act to make it where council lies or whatever else, so that it becomes a criminal case, but it wouldn't fit in there, because this is our decision taken by council, and we don't want those decisions overturned.
I may just ask, maybe flag that and we can raise it at some stage, because it cannot be that you can have someone simply, I will dismiss, and there are going to be repercussions.
Yeah, I think here it's not about the dismissal, it's more about the decisions. But my concern is, what do we do in a situation where two or three of the councillors have not declared interest? They take a decision that is favouring a certain company, for example. I do think we need to stop this whole issue by addressing the quorum. I think three needs to be addressed first. If we address three properly, then the other issues become less often an issue. But literally, I mean, we know of decisions that was declared by the two council members who were present at last year's annual report hearings. We literally wanted the decision, and they okayed the decision afterwards, and that can't be right.
Gee, if I can just add, I think we should just take note of, as well, of the words that says it's not invalid merely by reason of. It's leaving open that there might be legal reasons like fraud, like some other things that can show it was an illegal decision that was taken. But all the section saying is that not, if there's one of these issues that went wrong, it doesn't mean that the decision is not, is only as a result thereof is illegal. But there might be other legal grounds.
But can we go to three? Can we correct three first? Let's look at three first. Is the quorum for any meeting of the council is a majority? Is three members? I think we should say a quorum for the council is three serving councillors. Are we in agreement? Three members of the council. The quorum for any meeting of the council is three members of the councillors of the council. Did you hear what I was saying? You've got it. And we are in agreement, members? Okay. Quorum for any meeting of the council is three members of the council. End story. Okay, and then we're happy with seven as of evening. Given the explanation that you gave us, then let's go to 33.
Thank you, Chair. The Secretariat, 12A. 1. The council must appoint a secretariat consisting of not more than three members. 2. The secretariat must perform administrative and secretarial functions pertaining to the council in terms of this act. 3. A member of the secretariat appointed by the council may be paid from the funds of the authority such remuneration and allowances as the minister may determine with concurrence of the Minister of Finance.
We want you to explain what you envisage. We ask for a secretariat, and the reason why we ask for a secretariat is for the fact that no longer going to have full-time chairperson, you're now going to have part-time, therefore somebody needs to prepare documents on behalf of the council, etc. Can you be more specific about what you visit here? For instance, levels of appointments is something that worries us. Is this a full-time job? Is what are we looking at? And the reason why we ask this, just last week, again, we heard about appointments of people more than R1 million that we can't see anything that they delivered. So we really worry about this. Also last year one of the issues was the fact that current secretaries were earning more than senior investigators within the authority. Now the core business of the authority is the senior investigation part of it, is the investigation part of it. So we are a bit worried about this section. Can we get some clarity on this issue? Who else wanted to add something before they respond?
I'm virtually covered. We see very bizarre situations going on here. I was wondering if this so-called secretariat could not exist, be pulled together from existing employees of the entity, rather than create yet another level this huge expensive entity of people who we know nothing about and who earn R1.5 million a year, and basically we end up with one of the worst auditor general reports we've ever seen yet again.
Yeah. I think that when we discussed this when we were with the committee at the last hearing, was that we need this body needs to account to the council. Because the council is now part-time, they needed a secretariat and a proposal in practice that is not the authority, because they might have differences with the authority and issues that they need to oversee it. Our idea was that you would need to have a company secretary. If you look at most entities and boards, they have a company secretary. Now, a company secretary is not a PA, it's different to a PA. It's somebody who is actually a bit more high-powered than just an ordinary PA or secretary and two support staff. That was our kind of thinking, based on what happens with other boards and entities, that you have this company secretary, and company secretary has a support team, an administrator, and a kind of secretary around them. Secretary in terms of what we understand of a secretary.
Now I'm becoming even more worried. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I'm wondering whether the authority is at the right place for the appointment of the secretary. My only concern is if it's not there, where does it go?
Sir Chair, the council is appointing the secretary.
We looked at the section, and it was something that was even made by the committee, that this needed to be doing council work, not authority work. It needed to be doing the council work, making sure that the agendas, the right items were under the agendas, that the reports were received, that in the instance that those reports were able to be summarised and presented to council, etc. And we looked at other boards, and they do have company secretary's office that performs that function. And that's what we were looking at.
In the examples that you looked at, who appoints that secretary?
The board.
So is that a full time? It's not linked to the board's term of office?
Yes, often full time, so that it allows for continuity in a situation, so that if a new council comes in, you have continuity.
But then I would like to see at least, that we clarify the difference of roles and responsibilities between the executive director and the company secretary on the one hand. Secondly, the agreement by the minister at least on the appointment of the secretary. Because the minister is determining the salary in any case through the Minister of Finance. And I think we need to be clear here in terms of the process of appointment as well. Advertising, open advertisement, applications, etc.
We level
that is determined by the Minister of Treasury and the Minister of Police together, determining depending on the work. Because honestly, our concern is informed by experience. Is it possible, Mr. Jacobs, or are we asking for the impossible?
I think you can expand a bit on this.
Will you expand a bit on the issue? Maybe just look at the examples that you've looked at, what is in those examples, also maybe in terms of requirements of such a person, and the appointment process as well. Surely this person must also be expected to get the security clearance if they're going to work with the work of the council. I'm just mentioning one requirement that comes to mind. So that one we will come back to after you've looked at it.
Chair, 13 on page 33, committees to assist council. 13.1, the council may appoint one or more committees consisting of A, one or more councillors to lead the org, B, one or more councillors and one or more other persons, or C, one or more other persons to advise or assist the authority in relation to any matter referred to it by the council and to report on that matter to council. Two, the council must establish committees representing different sectors, disciplines or interests in the private security industry to advise it regarding the regulation of the private security industry, provided that no remuneration or allowance as contemplated in section 8.6 may be paid to a member of a committee established in terms of this subsection. And the rest of the section remains as the East Chair.
Members, can I hear you on this section? These persons, the Honourable Nalabati, Honourable Kulabana.
Chapter 20, the one or more. What does it mean? What does it mean? Any number. What does more mean? More than plus.
I do see that you say that there are no allowances, there's no pay for this committee. So, but it's just so vague. I agree with Honourable Manabas has really raised it as one or more persons of any description. Are we talking about specialists in the field? I don't know, this whole section is just incredibly vague to me. To provide information to a panel that already consists of five experts in various fields. I initially was very skeptical, but when I read that there's no no remuneration or allowance at all, then maybe it's just a short-term committee. I mean, you envisage something that gathers together, produces a report, and it disbands. I'm not sure what is actually being envisaged here.
To that, you see, for me, the problem is in 13.1. 32 for me is not the problem. 32 is what the industry is begging for. The industry is saying, consult us before you decide. Let us be involved. And the industry themselves will make people available to advise, etc., etc. How the authority gets to that point is fine. But one for me is a concern, because one is also not stipulating whether there's fees payable to these people. Are we talking about council members and members of the authority or personnel of the authority, or are we talking about council and outside people under one? Because it's not excluding that, neither is it's a specific. And my other concern here is that my understanding from this committee, the first, I'm talking now about 13.1, is that it is part-time, it's a short-term. For instance, we need to finalize the financial statements, argument so. We then, it's a small committee to look at it in detail on behalf of the council. I'm just using this maybe a bad argument because the AG will look at it. But, okay, let's take the building, for instance. What are we going to do with the building that we've left behind? We then say we want to establish a small committee that looks at the issue. That would be the type of things that one would be looking at. Two would be looking at the must establish. That's the industry relations. I'm not sure whether we're satisfying that in one specific year. I'm not that worried about two, but I'm worried about one.
John, I do beg your point. I read it as one entity with missing the first part of number two. So now well, my initial worries are absolutely back in full flood. This council appointing, it can be a committee for anybody, anywhere, paid any amount, and it's way too vague for my liking, especially as we will repeat it, considering the history of this entity. We've got to start again.
I really think you did not apply your mind properly to this one. I think we need to look at it. You will have to come back to us in this issue. Even CEO, one or more other persons.
I think it might clarify some issues if we refer back to section 8.6, which deals with the payment. The councillor or a member of a committee appointed by the council referred to in section 13.1. Who is not an employee of the authority or an officer or employee in the public service, may be paid from the funds of the authority such remuneration and allowances as the minister may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. I think it clears to some extent some of the concerns that have been raised, although I appreciate not all the concerns, Chair.
I think then what we're also asking is, may I appoint one or more committees consisting of, then you clarify those issues, to advise the authority. I would say that before we get to advice, this is in accordance with the section that you just read first, so that we refer back to that section. And then I still think we need to clarify that it's not full-time committees, it's committees to deal with specific issues, limited time. In the appointment, for instance, I would think if the committee is going to, let's say a committee dealing with the building, council will present to the minister and say, we're going to have one councillor and two people from outside looking at this issue. Not necessarily authority personnel. And it's going to be a 3-month project, and we see that they will meet 10 times. The minister will then say that, okay, I'm willing, after speaking to the Minister of Finance, to pay this amount to this group of people. If the 3 months is out and they have not completed their work, they've got to reply to the minister for the extension of that committee and for further funding of that committee. Because otherwise we're really opening a can of worms here. So
So if you can address those concerns, then we can come back to them at a later stage. Sorry for that, but I think we need to tighten it up while we're busy with it. Okay, let's continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 34, staff of authority, 14.1, the council must appoint, in consultation with the minister, a director of the authority as well as three deputy directors who are A, citizens of the Republic, and B, fit and proper persons, with due regard to their experience, conscientiousness and integrity, to be entrusted with the responsibilities with regard to their respective offices. 1A, persons appointed under subsection 1 must be made on such appoint conditions and terms as may be determined by the council. Yeah, I think there's something in the wording that we need to tighten up there. It's a bit vague. But persons appointed, it should rather be appointments under subsection 1 must be made on such conditions and terms as may be determined by the council.
I'm a bit worried about this. And I'm sure members are sharing my concern. There's no, it's in consultation with the minister. But then you allow the council to determine the salary. And we know that we currently have an investigation into the salaries of the authority. Now, in the end, the minister sits with the egg on his face. While it was, he had no say in this. And that would be the problem. Also, I would like to see a role for Parliament here, in terms of Parliament's involvement in similar to what we do with ICEN, the acceptance or rejection of such an appointment. I don't know, members, I hear you on this issue.
Could I know why you've taken out suitably qualified and experienced person? Because you've got to have fit and proper, so they're not crooks and they're not, with due regard to their experience, but experience doesn't mean they necessarily have the qualifications. Why did you take out suitably qualified from the top? You've alluded, but you haven't put it back perhaps under A, B, or you move on. So what have the qualifications?
Can you take our concerns on board? I think we need a redraft of this section. We definitely need a redraft of this section. Remember now as well, we're no longer going to have a full-time chairperson of the council. There's going to be more responsibility on the director in many ways for the day-to-day running of the work of the authority. Surely here we've got to be more specific. I think here again, look at what we put in the works legislation. Look what we put in the works legislation in terms of the appointment of the head of the works legislation. At least that kind of criteria must come into play with the executive director of this authority. Security clearances, suitably qualified, experience, honourable, whatever. Do you want to say something sexually?
Yeah, we can almost check what we put into the DPCI, but then there's also the question of contract, because that would change the contract period.
That's fine. You put it in. That's fine. It might be not a bad thing. It might be not a bad thing if this comes up for contract periods. It might be not a bad thing.
One of the positions in a position and contracts.
Yes. These are up for contracts. Your own contracts are up for. And I mean, so there must be a mechanism of saying, sorry, you haven't performed as we expected you to do, and therefore X, Y, or Z. Or thank you very much, you did perform, and we're going to extend your contract to a second period. And maybe we must also look at the limitations around the appointment. Because as you said earlier, this is an industry that's got millions and millions, in fact billions of that. It's turnaround is close to the budget of the South African Police Service. So money is available. And we don't want to have a situation where
people in these positions become influenced by the industry themselves as well. So can you have a look at that in the redraft first? Mrs. Is there anything else, I'm coming to you, Ms. Kulavan, anything else suggestions under this that you want to highlight for them so that when they redraft it that they can also take it in consideration? Honourable Kulavan?
Just two things. Please don't forget that there were three deputy directors to whom this is also applied. And I think, you know, there is best practice in regard to appointments of people such as financial officers, etc. They must have 10 years experience in the field or whatever. We're talking, you know, an entity that has had millions come in and they don't know where it's come from. I mean, literally, this has been the most bizarre entity for years. So they're going to have to pull it together and control finances, run entities, basically from scratch. So they have to have extreme experience when it comes to dealing with these millions and millions of rands flooding at this entity.
So can we move on? I think you've got a vague feeling of what it is that we want there. You could come back with suggestions. I also take the point of the Honourable Kulavan in terms of the deputy directors as well. So that, look at the whole situation. I think in terms of the deputy directors, the provincial head that we've got might not want to take it completely. That there you might not want to do a contract part of thing, but let's look at what apply your mind and come back to us on that issue, please.
Thanks, Chair. Subsection 2, the director, if deleted, and deputy directors of the authority must subject to the council's direction and control. Chair, the reason why and deputy directors have been removed was to place the accountability on one specific person and not have it as a broad power.
So we've already started to change the job around the director. That's the point. Okay, continue, please.
Chair, then you see, ensure that the functions of the authority are performed in terms of this Act, the Levies Act, and the Public Finance Management Act. This is just a consequential amendment. If prepare the strategic and annual performance plan of the authority in accordance with the Public Finance Management Act. 3, the director with the lead and deputy directors. So the director of the authority may, in writing with the approval of the council, delegate any of his or her powers and assign any of his or her duties to a staff member of the authority.
Can I ask now, with approval of the council, do we really want the director now, given the fact that we are redefining this position, to have to go to council to get authority to delegate duties? Because that's what it boils down to. Secretary?
Currently, even as a head of the department, send to the minister once a year our delegation list for the executive authority to sign. So there's nothing wrong with council signing that off. The head of department can send their delegation through to the executive authority who signs off on those delegations anyway. So now you're giving the council that responsibility that other government heads have to report to the executive authority.
But then you need to put it more clearly, because this seems like it's a day-to-day thing that if I want to delegate somebody to do something, I've got to run council first. So let's put it clearer to say that delegation powers, as you put it now, once a year must go to council for council. I mean, to go in the beginning of the term. And then on the additional ones, every now and then. So just tighten that for us as well, please. Continue. Is there anything else?
Thank you.
Just one other thing. What do we do here if the director is hit by a bus? There is no reference to delegation to or appointment of an acting director, perhaps from one of the three deputies, or delegation of powers, the full powers of the director to an acting, or how one goes about doing that. Maybe I'm missing it, but I haven't seen it.
Chair, I'm sure there is provision for the acting situation. We haven't dealt with it yet, but there is provision for it. Thank you. 4A, the bottom of page 36, the director of the authority may appoint, subject to this act and to general or specific directives of the council, the staff of the authority that may be necessary to perform the work arising from or connected with the authority's function in terms of this Act, the Ladies Act and the Public Finance Management Act, also just a consequential amendment. The Chair, it's proposed that subsection 5 be deleted on page 36, star appointed in terms of this section may either be appointed as employees or in terms of a contract for a fixed period. And sub 6, the terms and conditions of service of the authority staff and their remuneration, allowances, subsidies, and other service benefits must be determined by the Council in consultation with the Minister. And 7, the fixed establishment, the number and grading of posts of the authority must be determined by the Council with the approval of the Minister after consultation with the Minister of Public Service and Administration. Here, of course, the deletion of subsidy 5 is as a result of these following subsections which actually tightens the control over the appointments.
Ms. Kulwana?
Just one in B. I used the most unfortunate term earlier, saying it may be headed towards its sell-by date. I'm absolutely withdraw that. But I do think that the phrase from the legal practice book, where it says it's broadly representative of the Republic's demographics, may be more suitable in B to replace that particular phrase.
I also want to ask on that specific phrase, given that what we said in the beginning, whether it's necessary to repeat it here, because the fact of the matter is the Employment Equity Act, the BEE, everything applies to these entities as well. Yet as part of the object of the authority in terms of broadening the ownership, etc., that is an objective that they must achieve. But I'm not sure whether we need to be have this in here as well. At the time when this Act was written, it was necessary, but we're now reviewing it, and there are now legislation. Remember, the Employment Equity wasn't there at that point in time. So I'm just asking that question as well in terms of that. Then I've got another question. I want you to respond to that first, please.
Yeah, I think this has got a historical context. The CERA is now a public entity, so it's governed by all government's equity processes, but the equity, the broad economic empowerment. I think there's a particular history to this clause, so those things would now govern the appointment of senior heads.
Maybe you could just look at it, saying the letter must implement itself, must appoint staff according to, and then the relevant legislation. Relevant equality legislation, or whatever you want to call it. But I'm sure we can be less wordy around that issue. I have another problem. Commissioner Jacobs. And that is around the Dental Tourism, my point. Why special directions of the Council? I'm sorry, 4A, on page 25. Why special directions of the Council? But because for me this becomes our Council determining who and where you must appoint, which should be the responsibility of the Executive Director. Sure, I don't have to the general direction of the Council, I don't have a problem, but I do have a problem with special directions.
Chair, I mean, doesn't number 7 now address this one, as the director of the authority must appoint staff, but number 7 now determines the fixed establishment around which he's appointed.
But then, do you still need 4?
Yeah, I think so, because 7 relates to the fixed establishment, and 4 is the appointment of the staff themselves, so it's actually two different issues.
But my question is, why should the Council be the one that interferes in this?
But Jay, I agree that if there are general guidelines by the Council, it's fine. I don't know, I can't see that special, because you will have a certain criteria in terms of which appointments will be made, etc., and how to consider them, etc., and it should not be subject to special directions from the Council.
You see, I think you must relook the thing again. The fixed establishment, I think 7 needs to move earlier, first of all. The fixed establishment number and grading of postal authority must be determined by the council with the approval of the minister after consultation with the minister of public service and administration. Even that thing needs to be patterned. The fixed establishment number and grading of postal authority must be determined by the council in consultation with the minister of public service and administration and the approval of the minister. So what we're saying is, council can't go on its own and determine this is what the fixed establishment is, and then go to public service and say this is the fixed establishment. Now you grade the post. It must be a joint process. And then minister approves. So can we look at that one? And then I think it must move up. And then the director of the authority must avoid the staff of the authority that may be necessary to perform the work arising from all connected with the authority's functions in terms of this Act, Levy Act, and Public Finance Manager Act. I'm not sure.
Chair, I'm slightly contentious with your proposal with regard to council consulting with the Minister of Public Service and Administration. I think it would be more probable for the minister to consult at that level with the minister. So I think the way it is now is probably because the approval of the minister would require that the other minister is also in agreement with what the council has determined to do.
Didn't listen what I said. I said the council, in consultation with public service and administration, and this, I left out the Minister of Public Service and Administration. I left out the Minister. So I'm saying official to official. And then approval by the Minister in terms of that. And should Treasury not also come in here? Secretary?
The process before the Minister of Public Service and Administration approves the structure, she, as she does ask Treasury, it's one of the formal processes that she required approval from Treasury, job rating, etc., report goes to our Minister and their Minister for approval. So that does happen anyway.
Yeah, but are you in agreement with what we're saying? Because my understanding, let's take the Secretariat for example. You have been a secretary in consultation with your counterpart in public service and administration, saying to them, this is what we need, this is what we are supposed to be doing, how many posts do we need, help us to determine what levels, etc., etc. Then there's agreement between yourselves, public service and administration, if there's a crossing done. It then goes to their minister at Treasury, before it goes to our minister to say, we've agreed on. Yeah, our minister will send it, then after you've agreed as officials, it will go to our minister, who will then send it to the Minister of Public Service and Administration and the Minister of Treasury for their agreement. Okay. So if we can just look at that, but I still feel this section has moved up, because maybe introduce the rest of the section. Anything else under this section? Honourable Lovatsi.
Thank you, Chair. I need an explanation on this grading of posts. An explanation, please.
The way it works is when you approach DPSA, you say this is what you need. DPSA will then say, give us the job description and what you want the person to do. They will then sit with you and say, based on what the task of this person is, we are grading the post at level 11. If you don't agree with us, you have to motivate why it should be level 1. So that's what the grading of posts is all about. So when you do your fixed establishment, it's not just that they say this is how many staff you need. They do a job evaluation and they then grade that post to be at a particular level. If you want to change that level, you've then got to motivate to DPSAY that graded, what the grade is supposed to be should be changed.
So 7 should then read something like, and I'm not saying that exactly, fixed establishment number and grading of post of authority must be determined by the council in consultation with public service and administration and with approval of the minister after consultation with the minister of public service and administration. So it's just that sign off afterwards, but you can do the wording around that. Are you satisfied with the answer, Ms. Mulabatsi? Okay, then continue, please.
Now, where should 7 be, Chairperson?
I'm suggesting that 7 move up to 4. That 7 take the place of 4, and then 4 can follow after that. So you first talk about the process of establishing the staff establishment, and then you go to the appointment of those. Are we happy with that, members? Okay. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. And if we come to section 15 on page 36, I have no mandate to say this or what, the Chair, but the committee has asked that we must look broadly at the whole Act. If we look at 15.1, subject to subsection 5, the Council may assign any of its functions or duty and delegate any of its powers, except the power to make rules to its chairperson or to any committee appointed in terms of section 30. I was just wondering, Chair, in view of all the other things we've done in the Act, whether that power is not allowed as well.
Quite correctly so. Honourable Philibana?
I absolutely agree. It's ringing warning bells in my head too. I can just imagine the case giving the council the ability to actually delegate all their powers away to other people, and there's no real checks or balances. I mean, I know they're not divested of their power, but other people are doing the work. So I have a huge problem with leaving that so wide open. It's just a disaster waiting to happen.
Also, in terms of the way that it was here was when we all were having full-time chairpersons. We're now saying no. So you've got to, I think, instead of us now discussing this in detail, can we ask you to relook 15, because there might be other sections within 15 that might also be of effect. Agreed? And then we can come back to 15. Tomorrow we will only start to meet at 2 o'clock, so you've got the whole of tomorrow morning as well to look at these things and to come back to us on that. Finances of the authority, let's start there.
Thank you, Chair. 16.1, it starts with the authority is financed from A, registration fees, levies or monies from any legitimate source which are accrued to the authority in terms of this Act or any other law, and B, money that may be appropriate by Parliament where necessary, appropriate and justifiable. 2, the Council must, subject to the Public Finance Management Act and Section 16A, A, account for money received or paid on account of the authority, and B, cause the necessary accounting and other related records to be kept. 3, the records referred to in subsection 2B must be audited by the Auditor General. And 4, the director must report to the council in respect of the financial affairs of the authority as and when required.
That's too lenient. As and when required. We're saying that the council must meet at least once a quarter. I would suggest a standing item on their agenda to be the financial statements. Because they've got to prepare quarterly reports, financial reports in any case, to go to the minister. He can do so more often when required, but at least quarterly to the council. Council must start playing its role in terms of the responsibilities of the finances. Can we hear you on that one?
Can I ask 1B, what does 1B mean?
1B? That is registration fees, levies of money from any legitimate source. That is the levies that the individual security officers pay over, the levies that companies pay over. It is a reason this is supposed to be a self-funding entity. Through levies, which is a tax, that's why we've got oversight over them. All those matters, license fees, it's accreditation fees of security service providers, of training institutions, etc. B is the more important thing for us. You would remember that the introduced bill wanted this to be...
I was talking about 1B.
Yep. B is more important for us, because B, the introduced bill, was asking for this to become a... basically a designated department with votes from Parliament. But it wasn't consulted with Treasury. Treasury, that's what the Secretary reported on this morning as well. Treasury said, no, that's not what entities do. So what be that allow for? Let's say the industry runs, the authority runs into trouble, like the Secretary explained earlier this morning, the industry decides to boycott. B can then allow them for Treasury to give them a loan or a help, a financial assistance. That's what it does. But that must come through Parliament. Through, like all other... It's like when we talk, let's use a bad example, but it's a good example in this case. If I where they ask for money to assist them to continue the work they're supposed to be doing. So it will go through that same process. It will come to us, it will go to Finance Committee, it will go to Treasury, etc. And we will have to decide on that. Which is not going to be an easy decision to get out of us at this stage. Okay, so are we happy with that part of it? Can I just ask about the wording of B? Money that may be appropriated by Parliament where necessary, appropriate, or justifiable. That doesn't make quite sense. Is it not the drafting that might be an issue there?
It may be drafting, but I think National Treasury wanted to make sure that they're not obliged to do it, just because...
That's in a sense. Maybe appropriated by Parliament. Sorry, Commissioner Jacobs, you had your hand up. Do you want to respond?
No, it's another issue.
It may be appropriated by Parliament when necessary and justifiable. Is there not one appropriation too many, maybe? When necessary and justifiable. So that makes it clear that it's not a yearly amount that they're going to get. Primary obligation is still for them to get their levies in and get their taxes in and whatever else. Happy with that?
Thanks, Chair. It's just in terms of consistency, Chair, I would just propose that in A, we just add the In Levies Act as well, because it is applicable to say that registration fees, levies or monies from any legitimate source which have accrued to the authority in terms of this Act, the Levies Act or any other law. We have everywhere brought in the Levies Act and the Public Fund Management Check.
Is the Levies Act now in existence?
It's not in operation yet, Chair.
Can you make a note of it that we, in transitional arrangements, also put a date to when we want it to be operational at the latest, please?
The word appropriate there, I think, probably is appropriate. I mean, I'm presuming it's also a term from other legislation, but yeah, I think it you know, means suitable, proper, etc.
I think you're right. I withdraw my statement there. But it still, it reads fine. That's the problem. Money that may be appropriated upon where necessary, appropriate, and justifiable. If you read it that way, it is actually correct. Okay, that's fine. Okay, continue please.
Chair, the annual report that's on page 3816A. 1, the Council must prepare and submit to the Minister an annual report in terms of section 55(1)(d) of the Public Finance Management Act. 2, the annual report referred to in subsection 1 must include the following documents. A, the audited financial statements prepared in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. B, the Audit General's report prepared in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. And C, a report on the activities of the authority undertaken during the year to which the audit relates, including matters 1, referred to in section 10(1)(a), and 2, pertaining to the exemptions granted or refused and the reasons therefore. 3, the Minister must file in Parliament a copy of the annual report, financial statements and the audit report on those statements within 1 month after receipt thereof if Parliament is in session, or if Parliament is not in session within 1 month after the commencement of its next ensuing session. 4, the Director must publish the annual report, financial statements and audit report on the those statements once titled in Parliament.
Mavis, can I hear you on this section?
Could I know, this phrase in the three, about when it was tabled, is that the general phrase used in relation to all annual reports? It just seems to me that if we may have a situation where Parliament doesn't sit for some months and then you have no need to actually table it. So it just seems a bit vague. But if it's the same term used in all such legislation in relation to annual reports, obviously it's fine. But it just seems to me that there's no specific time frame here.
Why don't we simply refer to as prescribed in the PFMA? Because there's a deadline for all departments by when it must be submitted, which we are in any case discussing because we're not happy with the deadline. We believe it should be 1 month earlier, so that the gifts committee is enough time to deal with that before the budget appropriation is done, adjustment appropriation is done. So I would suggest that. But if we just go one section back, there is now your references and the sea. I think that's changed. You must look at that, please. The references and the sea. The reference to section so and so pertaining to digital grants or refusing the instance for therefore. Just look at that. I'll give you the wording of section 26.9. We must just include that as well. 26.9 and 32.3. 26.9, as far as I know, is on page 30. 32.3 is on page 57. So you can just look at that. Then, the other thing that I want to ask, why are we not putting an obligation on CIRA to report in its annual report on its investment account?
Can we check what the PFMA, because my understanding is all money has to be reported on.
That is my concern. We don't know what money goes into that investment account. We don't know what money comes out of that investment account. Every single year we've got to ask the question, what is your balance in your investment account? And that in itself is not good enough in terms of oversight. We want to know what goes in, we want to know what goes out, and what are the reasons for that. It's not body's personal account. So, check for us, but even if it's not a requirement, I think we need to look at the possibility of reporting on this investment account. And we say this specifically because we know also from previous experience that they would treat poverty at March, April, ask the minister to intervene in terms of salaries, meanwhile they've got an investment account of 50 or 40 million rand, currently it's 40 million. So, we want to have a declaration on the investment account. And maybe audit statements on the investment account. So can you check on that one first? Members, are there anything else under this section? And also, four, the director must publish the annual report, financial statement, and audit report on the statements once they were in public, in Parliament. The director must make public the annual report, financial statement, audit report on those statements once they were in Parliament. For as well, this is one entity where it's not even on their webpage. It's not there. It's literally the copies in Parliament. But we know that there are copies being kept locked away. That does not get to the public. This is public money. Whether it's through levies or not, it's public money. Levies is a tax. Fees is a tax. So we need to be a bit more clear on this one. I think there are legislation, if I remember correctly, in this where it's very specific in terms of it must be published on the website, it must be made public, whatever else. What happens with FIA statements? What happens with the... Can we look at that and come back to us, please? Can I get an indication from the Executive Director of CIRA? Where is the delegation gone to now?
Beg your pardon, Madam Chair, the last one. Where?
Has CIRA's delegation gone to now? Because you were introduced to us this morning, I think you're the only one left now.
Normally the procedure is if people are going leave, they inform the chair.
Thank you, Chair. The council member that was with us had his laptop swapped with another person's laptop on the plane, so they called him to come and collect. The chairperson, I assume that he went to the bathroom, which just went out now.
And to head of Westgate that you introduced us?
Yes, the person said that he stayed on for 2 hours, Madam Chair.
I don't take kindly to this disrespect. I expect that when a delegation is introduced to the committee, if somebody in that delegation leaves, that make it clear in the beginning that that will happen, or that you at least inform the chair through the secretary of the committee about such movements. Can we continue, please?
So are we not also wanting to, in line with an earlier comment you made, also to ensure that the annual report reports on meetings of council?
Yeah. I think that list that you're speaking about now, Secretary, where is it? Commissioner Jacobs? There was previous list where we said something called... Yeah. That list should actually be duplicated in the annual report. What they must report to the minister must be duplicated in the annual report. I think that makes it much easier as well. And I think, Secretary, backwards working. Reporting on the investment fund must be also included in the reporting to the minister, and it must also be on a quarterly basis. And then, as I said, duplicate that it is also part of the annual report. Reporting. Continue.
Thank you, Chair. On page 39, Chair, as a result of the changes with the Public Finance Management Act and the whole regime that comes in there, section 17, 18 and 19 of the Act must be deleted, Chair. Indicated as such on the text.
Because now everything will be done according to the PFMI. Perfect. The agreement, members are not necessary to have all of that, it's now far stricter it is in accordance with the PFMI.
Before we move on, I raised an issue about the director, and if the director was hit by a bat, and I was told there would be powers elsewhere somehow, giving some deputy the chance to come in and take over the job, but I just haven't seen it. We're about to move on. I don't know. I've just paid through. I don't see another section where I think it might pop up. Is it someone hiding and someone not finding it?
Chair, no. On the reconsideration, I think it's an issue that we need to look at in the book. I was confused with the issue about the council and the interim measures on the council. But I think in terms of the temporary appointment of the director, we might need to look at that as well.
Yeah, can you look at it also in terms of how you deal with it in other entities? For instance, I know that the secretary being here today have to appoint an acting secretary. Well, not necessarily here today, but you've got to appoint an acting secretary up there, and it's got to go through the minister. So, and we look at it that it's more or less in line with that. So whether it's on incapacity, or it is because of suddenly becoming vacant, or whatever the case may be, that we do make provision for that.
Okay, then on page 41, we have inserted in section 21, we've inserted a subsection C, a security business may not use the services of a person who is not registered in terms of this act to render a security service. Chair, I think this was something that was lacking in the act up until now. Then sub 2, a security business may only be registered as a security service provider If all the persons performing executive or managing functions in terms of such security business are registered as security service providers, unless such person is exempted in terms of this Act, there is a provision for the minister to exempt persons from certain of the provisions of the Act. Then on page 42, Chair, subsection 5, the minister may, after having regard to the recommendations of the Exemption Advisory Committee, referred to in section 28, by notice in the Gazette exempting a security service provider or security service provider belonging to a category or class specified in the notice, either generally or subject to such conditions as may be specified in the notice, from the operation of any provision of this Act, or B, service, activity, practice, equipment, person or entity from any provision of this Act, as long as it does not prejudice the achievement of the objects of this Act. And six, the minister must take a decision within 90 days of receipt of the application for exemption contemplated in this Act, and in the case of refusal, provide the applicant with reasons within 30 days of the date of receipt of the request for reasons.
We want something added to this, please. We want to have it to you to add that the minister must publish in the government gazette those exemptions and the reasons for exemptions. Honourable Mulabata and Bukula Barnett.
Section 7 that was giving you the exemption was removed. Why?
The government is a court.
It will, we will put at that chair.
Why did you remove it?
Chair must confess, I don't know.
Okay, but just for the Honourable Kulabon, if you had something?
I've got a couple of issues here. On 20B, now you refer to a security service contemplated in section 199. Can you give the sub... 199 is very large. I don't know if there's a specific clause you can refer to narrow that down there. And then, if we look at 2A, unless a foreign-owned security company is exempted under the, by the Exemption Advisory Committee, all the directors, whether they're executive or non-executive, then have to be registered as security service providers. I think we had the discussion during the hearings. And this follows from the provisions of Clause 22A. So it's just not clear what it meant by executive or managing function. And it could possibly be cleared up by just saying executive management functions on a day-to-day basis. Because that would allow security companies in relation, which would follow the provisions of Companies Act, but not reach the, quote, fair and equitable treatment provisions of the UK-South Africa Bilateral Investment Treaty, which was the concern raised during the hearing. So it's just it is a slight addition of executive management functions on a day-to-day basis. The people who are hands-on obviously have to have that. I'm going to look at the actual reference. If the registration as security provider, then that would make more sense in relation to bilateral.
We are now.
I'm on 2A.
Page 40.
Page 41.
41.
I've got another two or three issues on the second.
Let them first respond to this one.
Yeah, I think in A we exactly provide that a person may be exempted if he is on the executive or involved in the executive or managing functions. And I think that B in which the person is involved might be an influence in the application. But I think it's actually broader as what has been proposed now, because there must be a case made out why the exemption must take place and to what degree. So I think as it is now, it's actually right enough to cut it for any possibility in terms of the level of involvement of the person in the management of the security service provider.
I remember, but I remember the concern more around the issue of the ownership that came in there. They didn't have that much problems with this part of it. And the fact of the matter is, this is where we must also look at national interest. In terms of, it's a requirement for somebody to do business in South Africa to register. Whatever business it is. If it's a foreign-owned business, they must register the directors, etc., etc. And this is nothing more than what we're asking for there, if I understand it correctly, unless I'm understanding it wrongly. Can I hear you on that? And then, Honourable Kulabat, I'll come back to you again.
No, Chair, I think that his interpretation is quite correct on that. And as a matter of fact, we don't receive a huge lot of these applications for exemption. But if I think about the example that we have received in the past, I personally think that one would actually limit the application of this by just looking at the level of the person's involvement in the... because it's open to the minister's discretion here in terms of the motivation on why he would exempt a specific person from certain of the legislation and other requirements.
Your concern on
199?
Just be, what was raised with me was that there are security companies who may have a non-executive director who's not hands-on, and yet now, and this, it seems, would have now to go through the processes when they're a non-executive director. So there were concerns in terms of the UK South Africa bilateral, and that was why there was just this, if it's a day-to-day hands-on director, absolutely, but it was a non-executive that this may have an impact on, and then there's going to be issues about the bilateral. So that was why this issue was raised.
I think you have discussed the issues of bilaterals with DDI to make sure that everything is covered in terms of that. My concern, Honourable Kulamarnat, in terms of what you're suggesting, is, let's say, for instance, Osama bin Laden was a non-executive director of a security company. Surely we would want to know that. We would, as a country, would want to know that. And that, the point is, we can't open a loophole here either. You can respond.
Yes, sorry, I was going to take a call, but currently, that's the way it works. Currently, if they're non-executive director, you apply to the Minister for Election from the provision, and then the problem is our bilateral with regard to that. So we get requests on an annual basis, maybe 4 or 5 requests from different companies saying, I don't perform security businesses, this is what I am, and the minister then gets a legal opinion and exempts me or doesn't exempt me.
Members,
are
we satisfied? Can we move on to your issue on 199, section 199 of the Constitution? You can respond to that, Commissioner Jacob.
Yes, Chairperson, the section 199 refers to the South African Police Service, Defence and the State Security Agency. So we need to capture all three of them. And I think it's correct like this, Chair.
See, that 8 subparts, that's a massive part of the Constitution. So I just thought if we could put section 199 and then called
it
X to X, it may make more sense.
But it's referring to the whole section, because it refers to the government security forces. It refers to police, it refers to defence, it refers to state security. That's what it refers to. So it is the whole section of 199, 128.
Page 42. There is a sentence, the end of number 3 at the top. It says, those sections, subsections 1, 2, or section 446, is invalid to the extent to which it is so inconsistent. Now, I've read it 5 times. I cannot make English out of that.
No, it's legal jargon. It's correctly drafted, I think, but it's not easy reading. You can...
It is invalid. The total thing is not invalid. It's the extent of which it is inconsistent that is invalid. So it doesn't become invalid because of the inconsistency, but that inconsistency is invalid.
I think this is also intended as a sort of a transitional revision with the Act coming in relation to the Security Officers Act.
Is it still necessary for that?
It needs to be part of the Act because it, in respect of all the cases as well, all the matters, I think we should not bother with it.
Okay. Are you clear on it? Okay, is there anything else under this? We do have kept it now that we want to see back names of exemptions received and outcome thereof published in government gazette, which disappeared. Can I just ask, in terms of that, should the exemption advisory committee not come before the exemptions? No.
It remains because 20 talks about the obligation to register. Did the exemptions go for
it? It's been continued with the Exemption Advisory Committee.
Thank you, Chair. 20A on page 42. 1. The Exemption Advisory Committee is hereby established. 2. The committee consists of a representative of A. The authority. B. Civilian Secretariat. C. Department of Home Affairs. D. Service. E. Department of Trade and Industry. And F. State Security Agency. Appointed by the Minister. The representative of the Civilian Secretariat must be a legally qualified person and must chair the committee. 4. The committee must make recommendations to the Minister in respect of exemptions referred to in section 25. 5. The Minister may prescribe procedural matters and the factors to be considered in relation to the function of the committee referred to in subsection 4. 6. The regulations referred to in subsection 5 must be tabled in the National Assembly for scrutiny and adoption, A, within 6 months of promulgation of this Act, and B, thereafter at least 30 days before promulgation of regulations, while it is in session or after the next session starts. Chair, maybe in respect of mentioning of this Act, we might need to write out the specific name of this Act because this will be taken up in the new Act. It's not a transitional provision that will stand separately.
Can I hear you? Members? This was a committee suggestion as it is. Are we satisfied just to say that there's a V in B that in B that shouldn't be there? While it is in session or after the next session starts, the V must come out. You've read it correctly when you read it, but we're still happy with the way that we've got this exemption committee. The representative of the authority, the Civilian Secretary, Department of Home Affairs, Service, Department of Trade and Industry, State Security, the agency appointed by Minister. The representative of the Civilian Secretary must be a legal qualified person, must chair the committee. So that's you. Happy, it seems like it. Okay, continue please. Can I just get an indication? I know it's 12:45. I wonder whether we shouldn't stop here. And then we continue, it's 15 minutes, then we're in any case going break. Let's stop here. Then we can go from page 43 at the bottom of page 43. We will reconvene here immediately after the budget speech, which should be about 3:00. Can I ask the technical team and everybody else who's not in the house to watch the monitors to see when the Minister of Finance is about to finish? We will reconvene here. Irvin, can you please address the issue of the reports?
Chair, let me make this apology to honourable members. There are two versions of the report. We have, because of changes, made those available, and we have copies, new copies that we will distribute to all members right now. And then we can go. We want to take away those copies of the report. So I want to apologize for this issue on us. Get this right.
Yeah, the BRR report on SAPS.
On SAPS, yeah.
The SAPS report.
Only the SAPS.
Yeah, you're going to give the other one. It's just minor changes that they. No, no, no. No, you can keep your, members, can I just explain to you, you can keep your copy that was delivered to you yesterday. The copy that was distributed to you this morning, that doesn't affect you on the law. The copy that was distributed to you this morning is the wrong copy. They copied the wrong one. So can I ask if you take those copies back and give them the right copy? And I want to say to Mr. Kinnis, there's no such thing as extreme pressure when it comes to BRR reports. We work throughout night and day to get them done. So can you just give those copies and make sure that you give the right copy? Mark it, please can we mark that copy one? Mark it one so that we know we work from that copy this afternoon. The other one has been distributed to members. Over. I indicated this morning when we started the meeting that we're going to try and do it still today, but I think we might do it tomorrow. I'm just waiting to hear it for confirmation, then we'll do it tomorrow. Transferring your comments, members. Don't worry about transferring your comments to the new version. We will go through it slowly so that we can take your comments from the previous versions on board. My copy? Okay. Members, we will reconvene here 3 o'clock or as soon as possible. After the Minister of Finance has finished his speech. If you finish 2:30, please let's be here 2:30. We're not going to waste time, because the sooner we are here, the sooner we can finish tonight. Honourable Global?
No, Chairperson. Some of us, I mustn't say, no. It's fine. Let us say, when the House, when the Town's finished, we come back here, because there are some interviews that we have to do.
What do you know about finance?
I know where I am.
No, that's fine. Not a problem. All I'm saying is the House adjourns, we come here.
Please.